is the Grahamian Report. The unusual, weird news, anomalies, exopolitics. It's beyond the fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Grahamian Report with your host, Mike Evans.
From hundreds of miles beneath terra firma in the depths of the hollow earth, live from the Grahamian bunker, it's the Grahamian Report, your weekly one-stop shop for all the weird news, anomalies, and exopolitics from beyond the fringe, broadcast from our hollow bunker, deep within the recesses of the Moho discontinuity. I'm joined in studio, as always, by our fantastic producer and co-host, Mr. Chris Hayes. Chris, how are you this evening?
I'm pretty great tonight. You know, usually I'm not so great, but tonight I'm great.
I think you're always pretty great. Almost as great as the man who's pushing all the right buttons behind the master console here in Grahamian International Studios, Mr. Matt Oakley. Matt, how are you?
I'm fine. You hear that, Chris? Almost, but not quite.
Almost. Not well, quite. You know what, Micah? I do think you're small.
Oh, come on. Ooh. My goodness. You know, well, I'm so glad that I'm still larger than life in the minds of our listeners. Isn't that right? And you, my friends, are about to hear incredible, fantastic feats of the imagination. Things that will take you beyond the fringes of insanity and inside. It is the Grahamian Report, and it's the kind of thing that we do every week here on this program from 8 to 11 p.m. Eastern Time. Tonight we're going to be delving into all kinds of things. UFOs, extraterrestrial intelligence from other star systems, and the potential that we've been contacted by alien life from elsewhere out there, somewhere beyond the cosmos and the fringes of what we know within our static little universe here. Here we are on this little mud ball planet. We don't really know what's going on out there. For all I know, I'm actually joined in studio by a couple of aliens. No, I'm just kidding. They're not aliens. I know there's something else probably, though.
I never even saw these assholes before.
Well, I've seen these guys a couple of times before. Anyway, that said, you know, I wanted to touch on something. We always like to bring updates to the program, and I do have an update for folks this evening. One of those is that we were talking about Stephen Hawking, the famous physicist, and whether or not there would ever be technology that would allow for Stephen Hawking to be able to communicate again, because at this point, he is in a situation where his ability to speak is literally down to about one word, I believe, per minute. I mean, that's really limiting his ability to communicate, and so it must be incredibly difficult for him, not only in terms of actually trying to express himself, but coping with the fact that no doubt his mind is able to move quickly, but he's not able to articulate the things going on in his mind. And so we'd spoken recently on the program about whether or not there might be hope for Stephen Hawking and his ability to continue to relay the kinds of messages that his brilliant mind otherwise would be able to communicate to the world. Well, indeed, that very well may be the case. This week, a new study points to the fact that brain activity could one day be transformed into speech, literally a direct liaison between brain activity and one's ability to speak, perhaps through mechanical means. The part of the brain that interprets sound is called the superior temporal gyrus. Now, in a recent study, electrodes attached to this area allowed brain waves to be recorded by a machine, which then interpreted that activity of the human mind alone into audible sounds. Now, in this experiment, key words were played for participants who had the electrodes attached to this special portion of their brains. And much to the excitement of researchers involved, the audio being played for the participants was remarkably similar to the sounds that were actually being interpreted by that portion of the individual's brain. We have audio now regarding this remarkable experiment, in which you will hear the sounds, the words that were being played for these individuals, and then the sound that follows, which is the literal computerized interpretation of the brain waves recreating that sound. Here's the audio.
Each time you'll hear what the patients heard, followed by the computer reconstruction of their brain waves.
Walter?
No.
Doubt?
No.
Town?
No.
Well, they're pretty hard to decipher, but nonetheless have got scientists very excited.
The words we were hearing, there were Waldo, Doubt, and Town. And you can hear that the computer-generated noise, which again is literally the result of a human brainwave focusing on that word, and then the interpretation electronically of the brain's activity focusing on that word and trying to recreate it. What we're hearing there is, yes, as the speaker said there, rather jarbled, but nonetheless sounds very similar to these to these words that are actually being heard by the participants of this study. And so it is hoped, of course, one day that this kind of technology may be used in the creation of devices that will once again allow a new kind of electronic method for speech for those afflicted with debilitating conditions that would otherwise make speech impossible. So again, I found that very interesting. People have been emailing me this story all week, and the scientific community is obviously very excited about this because, again, for people like Stephen Hawking, who otherwise may literally soon be unable to communicate or very close to it, this could offer an opportunity for those kinds of individuals to have a second chance at being able to communicate complex ideas and sentences. Now, we're a good ways away from that right now, but with any hope, we will catch up. The technology will catch up in terms of what we're capable of doing and what we hope to be able to do with this. Again, in its infancy now, but within a few years, who knows where we'll be. We may have a new kind of technological speech for people who are afflicted with debilitating diseases and the like. That said, speaking of communications, electronic communications especially, we do have a few listener emails I wanted to touch on this week, because they have relevance to a few things we'll be discussing tonight. And there have been some fantastic input coming in from listeners recently. I'm always thrilled to get input from people when they delve into details about something we may have touched on the program. You know, even though we do 3 hours, folks, there's so much sometimes that we are trying to cover each week on this program that we aren't able literally to cover all the different stories that we want to touch on the program. And the ones that we do touch on, we aren't able to get in depth with all the information that we would like to get into. And with this, with some of the listeners writing in, we often will be, things will be brought to our attention on a level of depth sometimes that even as researchers, we're not able to, delve completely into, given the confines of a 1 hour program and then the week, the week's worth with everything else going on during a week. You know, keeping in mind that last week I was literally, I think, 2 hours before we took the air, I was submitting a book proposal to New Page Books in New York, and of course we've been planning the Paradigm Symposium, so there's been so much stuff going on. And I'll tell you that, again, it's wonderful when the listenership hears a story. They'll hear, the basic reporting, and then they'll chime in with information about that. One of those stories that we got was from last week. Jay Fincannon writes that, being familiar with spacecraft and satellites, I have an answer regarding a story we touched on last week. And he's talking about specifically a question. And this discussion stemmed from another letter that was written in to the Grayling Report from a listener. And the question was, how come we don't have real-time satellite monitoring systems that are already made available to the public? And is there a reason why we don't seem to have those? Is the government or is someone else trying to hide information from the public? Well, Jay Fincannon writes, there actually is something called the EchoStar. It's the world's first commercial communications satellite in geosynchronous orbit with a camera offering live video of the Earth. Now, the signal is supposed to be included on the feed to Dish Network satellite TV customers. Now, how real-time is it? Well, for various reasons, its cycle is 15 seconds per frame. That's still pretty good, I have to say. And it is really supposed to be sent as soon as it is gotten. Notice that it is only 25 kilometers per pixel and that the output is 720 times 486 pixels. That is 720 by 486. In other words, what that means is you're unlikely to see anything man-made unless it's, for instance, keeping in mind that this satellite is pointed directly back at Earth, you're not going to see anything unless it's like a nuclear blast or maybe a high-powered laser beam aimed directly at the satellite. But there are other things that the EchoStar has managed to film. In fact, at the website, which we're going to have linked at graylingreport.com, where you can look at some of the video that has been relayed by the EchoStar and also see how this would look. Again, I think that it's a pay-for service, but it is something that is being allowed and provided on the consumer level. Again, they said to Dish Network satellite TV customers. There are some videos that will give you an idea of what this looks like, and one of them, get this, is labeled a UFO. Now, of course, Jay Fincannon, who wrote this email, said that seemed highly unlikely at the given resolution. We looked at it earlier, Chris Hayes and I, and I'll tell you this, it does look more to me like space debris tumbling through the air. We'll have that again linked at graylingreport.com so that you can make a determination on your own. The Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, currently orbiting the moon and which has taken images of the Apollo sites, required 0.5 meter per pixel to see that hardware and the tracks left by our moon buggy, as well as the astronauts themselves. So this will tell you that if you really want to be able to see useful stuff, you need a camera with a pixel format, get this, 50,000 times that 720 pixels by another 55,000 times the 486 pixels. In other words, what we're getting up to, okay, is something that has far greater, you would need something with far greater resolution than what is being provided. The Kepler camera, presently looking for planets, has 94,617,600 pixels. So we need about 9 million Kepler cameras to do this high-resolution real-time capture. So, unfortunately, while there are satellite image feeds that are being allowed and provided to the public, I don't think that we're quite to the level of sophistication where that kind of information could indeed be used to monitor things on ground level. And keeping in mind that these are satellites that are actually out in Earth. You know, we've got Google satellite technology, of course, which is able to monitor things really on an almost frighteningly detailed level. And then there's the street view, which literally, I think there are some people out there who think that the whole world is being monitored thanks to Google Street View technology. And maybe that's the case. But at least with regard to satellite technology that is being allowed and provided to the public, there is something at very least that is getting close to that, and that is available right now.
I say we test it. I'm going to go up 20 stories. You just wait, you know, 20, 30 minutes for me to get up there.
Okay.
I'm going to run out in the street and just start running full bore down the street. See if you can catch me with the street view.
With the street view. Yeah, that's right. The Google Street View. So, but anyway, but a different kind of satellite. Well, that's not satellite. The street view, of course, isn't. But then again, the actual Google satellite from space, that's again, I think it's pretty almost scary, I would say, what kind of detail they are able to gather imagery here on Terra Firma, which is one more reason why, yes, we broadcast from a bunker hundreds of miles beneath the Earth's surface.
I'm proud of it.
It grants us a little immunity, doesn't it? A little protection until they can see through the ground itself, that is. And, you know, speaking of seeing through the ground, well, maybe we'll say seeing through water. Have you heard the latest about that thing at the bottom of the Baltic Sea?
The Millennium Falcon?
The Millennium Falcon. In fact, as I understand it, Popular Mechanics has now taken on the Millennium Falcon, okay? Because, yes, this story came out earlier this month. Remember that story from a few months ago? If you're not sure about what we're talking about, a group of treasure hunters discovered what looks like a huge circular object beneath the Baltic Sea. Well, some people were saying it actually looked just like the Millennium Falcon.
It really does.
The shape is incredibly reminiscent of the famous starship from Star Wars, where, Han Solo and Chewbacca flew around in, yeah. Well, it looks a lot
and
like
Lando.
That. And Lando Calrissian, yeah, that scumbag. Oh, he kind of redeemed himself.
Yeah, a little bit.
He made a comeback. But anyway, you know, actually, funny thing, Billy Dee Williams, the actor that played him, said he was on a plane one time and that these people kept giving him the stink eye. And he kept wondering what was going on. And as he got off the plane, I think that they said something along the lines of, how could you do that to Han, you know? And he said literally people despised his character so much that in real life as an actor, he couldn't go places without people, you know, despising him. Isn't that really when real life and fiction merge to the point that it's dangerous? That's uncomfortable.
Those are the moments I decide I'm going to lock myself in a bunker and do a radio show.
Yet again, here we are.
1,000 miles.
Yeah. Hundreds.
Whatever. Hundreds.
Let's not exaggerate. Matt, let's not exaggerate, you know, how deep underground we are. It's just hundreds of miles.
You know,
only hundreds.
You come to up and down so many times, you just stop paying attention, you know?
The long elevator ride, you know, we felt really good on the elevator ride down tonight. But anyway, all that said, the whole reason I bring up all this stuff is, you know, detecting beneath ground level, or in this case, beneath sea level, as these treasure hunters managed to do beneath the Baltic Sea. At a depth of about 300 feet, there was a strange circular object that was noticed on the bottom of the ocean there. And these individuals speculated, well, what if it is some sort of ancient, you know, ruin of some sort or something else? Perhaps, you know, some people had said it looked like a crashed flying saucer. Well, recently this unique story garnered the attention of a number of news sources, and among them was Popular Mechanics, who took a stab at it and said that they had a slightly different take on the subject. The problem, okay, according to Hanumant Singh, a researcher with the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute, is that the pictures of this roughly 190-foot-wide disc-shaped formation were taken using what's called a side-scan sonar, which is a relatively inexpensive type of sonar useful in finding sunken ships, for instance. Now, the images, according to Hanumant, therefore reveal several distortions that he says, quote, render them virtually useless for identifying an undersea formation. Among problems he cites are a reflection of the mysterious circular object visible on the right side of the original images, which indicates a wiring issue. He referred to it as crosstalk, and this, of course, shows that there's a problem with the actual wiring of the instrumentation being used by the ship. There are also problems with blank areas that are visible. You can see in the original images that there are lines right down the center of the page, and then also things fade to grade to a grayscale on either side of the image, which show that the sonar was not able to detect these so-called blank areas. Otherwise, they should have been able to be read, and therefore, according to Mr. Singh, this information is not usable in terms of trying to determine if indeed there is some sort of object on the base of the Baltic Sea. Now, no doubt the treasure hunters involved would contest that, and it is still their hope to try and get down there to find out what exactly, if there is something there, we are dealing with and what it actually might be. You know, I didn't gravitate immediately toward the idea of a flying saucer under the ocean, but I'll tell you what I did think. I thought maybe there was some sort of a large structure, and who knows, if indeed there was some evidence of an earlier civilization, it could show the way that, you know, the Earth has changed since then, and perhaps what was once above ground is now at the bottom of the Baltic Sea. When we come back, we'll get to the bottom of some other mysteries here on the Gray Alien Report. I'm Micah Hanks, and we'll be back right after this.
For most of us, chocolate is a guilty pleasure. Come on, admit it. You've got a sweet tooth just like the rest of us. But if I told you that eating chocolate was actually really good for your health and happiness, you'd probably say I was in La La Land. Hey, I wouldn't argue. Here's why. Every batch of the fine handcrafted chocolates at La La Land Organics Raw Chocolate is made from scratch, using organic, fair trade, and 100% natural ingredients. From the first bite, you'll know you're enjoying true quality, and the heart shape isn't the only way you'll feel the love. In fact, every chocolate from La La Land Organics is made by Melody Dawn Germain herself, and according to her own special recipe. You'll be enjoying Ecuadorian heirloom cacao in every bite, along with a selection of wholesome herbs and superfood supplements that not only make La La Land Organics delicious, but really good for your health and happiness. They're all natural, gluten-free, and no dairy, soy, or refined sugars are included, which help them boost your energy, reduce stress, and promote longevity. And as if healthy organic chocolates didn't remove the guilt factor enough, Melody ships all her orders in reusable, food-grade, non-BPA containers designed to eliminate toxic residue and cut down on environmental waste. Be sure and visit Melody's website at www.mdgnewmedia.com. That website again is mdgnewmedia.com. Just click chocolate in the toolbar at the top of the page. You can't miss it. And while you're there, you can see a full list of the ingredients that will be sure to put a smile on your face. And I promise, it's guilt-free. La La Land Organics Raw Chocolate. Why wait? That website again is mdgnewmedia.com.
The 9/11 memorial is for the 343 firefighters who didn't make it.
For my husband, who died that day.
And the first responders who saved my life.
Because the best of humanity can overcome the worst hate.
This is Robert De Niro. This year, as we open the 9/11 Memorial in New York City, we ask that you join us to honor, remember, and reunite. To learn more or to reserve your visit, go to 911memorial.org.
Brought to you by the 9/11 Memorial and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to the program. It is the Gray Alien Report, keeping you company every Tuesday from 8 to 11 p.m. Eastern Time. All kinds of things on the table tonight, and we are light in the darkness, a beacon of insight from the depths of the darkness, known as the Moho Discontinuity. That's our little dark corner of the web from which we broadcast to you on a weekly basis here at the Gray Alien Report. Indeed. You know, there were a lot of folks who were very upset about Popular Mechanics' determination of this strange object at the base of the Baltic Sea, and whatever it may or may not be, I think that, especially in the paranormal community, Popular Mechanics has become sort of persona non grata. You know, they are not really viewed as a shining beacon of you know, how do you want to put this? They are certainly a shining beacon of skepticism, but they are also viewed as those who will seek to debunk something, even if there seems to be evidence of the contrary. And so they've drawn a lot of harsh criticism for, of course, the publications that they've put out that are supporting a you know, solely terrorist explanation for 9/11, as well as, of course, there being virtually nothing at stake here in terms of whether or not there is something strange at the bottom of the Baltic Sea. Now, in my opinion, there very well may be something there, but we also should take into consideration the kinds of issues that Hanumant Singh, this researcher, has pointed out in the article as interviewed by, he appeared in the interview rather by Popular Mechanics. I think that it's clear that maybe these things should be taken into consideration, but there does appear to be something there, and if that sonar managed to get any kind of a reading of anything physical there on the base of the ocean at all, well, then there's something probably worth further exploration. But who knows? I don't think that we can really assert that it is, you know, truly a UFO, some sort of a flying saucer. I think, if anything, it looks more like some kind of a construction of some sort of a maybe a building or something like that. And that alone to me would be very interesting. I don't think it would have to be a UFO. And frankly, I don't think that very many experts out there are proposing that indeed that is what this thing is. So that said, you know, we've been talking a lot this evening about already communication and the way that communication is changing very quickly and what our notion of communication is and how it will change. Personally, I think that another trend that we're going to see further on into the future is going to be that there will probably be more and more electronic communication, less and less verbal communication. That's already really the case. I mean, think how often you communicate via email with people, you know? In your daily life, I think more people, for business reasons, use email and instant messenger and things like that, probably than good old-fashioned phone calls. And then the few people who are still doing phone calls, you know, who has a landline? We do have a studio landline here, for obviously for radio purposes. I think a lot of people, though, on the other hand, are utilizing cell phones and things like that that they can take with them. And when they're using their cell phone, half the time they're doing what with their cell phone? As opposed to actually making a phone call, they're going to be text messaging.
Exactly. And I was actually, I can't recall who it was I was listening to. Actually, Henry Rollins said it. Oh, yeah. He was talking about the reason that we have so much bad grammar when people are talking and poor English usage. He's like, it's because of the internets and texting, and you know, instead of people calling up and say, "Good morning, how are you?" It's "How are you?"
The letter U, yeah. It's this kind of, you know, the shorthand, this text speak, if you could yeah, call it that. You know, text speak seems to be the thing.
Yeah, and I totally agree with that statement, and that's why, like I said, give me a call sometimes.
Mm-hmm. That's right. It certainly is. Well, now, speaking of communication, whether it be by telephone or via the interweb or anything along those lines, long-distance communication, we'll say, there very well may have been some recent developments in terms of what I would like to call longest-distance communication. Yes, we're talking about SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. This has been ongoing. This isn't exactly, you know, brand new news, and I've put out a few inquiries to experts. We'd hope to have an expert actually on the program tonight who would be joining us live via Seattle to discuss this, because what has actually happened here is that on a number of occasions there have been short bursts of unexplainable radio signals, okay, that appear to be coming from deep space. And it begs the question, have we received a message from deep space at Arecibo? Arecibo, of course, being the location in Puerto Rico that is probably most famously associated with the SETI program and the search for communication from distant galaxies. A mysterious signal keeps coming from a region of space between the constellations of Pisces and Aries, and has been picked up on three different occasions by the Arecibo radio telescope in Puerto Rico. Now, the signal is very puzzling and does not resemble any known astronomical phenomenon. Researchers who have studied its frequency pattern do not believe that it is a natural interference or noise. Was the signal transmitted deliberately by an extraterrestrial civilization on a distant planet? Scientists at present remain cautious, but we cannot dismiss the possibility. And there are a number of reasons why we cannot dismiss that possibility. One, first of all, being that indeed this message seems to meet the criteria of a few things that, you know, first of all, what we refer to as the cosmic watering hole. This message falls well into this area of potential for being intelligent in origin. Now, Chris, you were talking with us a little bit before the program about that, and there are a number of reasons why this message has some experts hopeful. One of those has to do with the presence of hydrogen. Am I correct?
Yes. The excuse me. The transmissions are coming out at 1420 megahertz, which is the experts say the frequency at which hydrogen absorbs and retransmits information.
Mm-hmm. And so again, this is something that's got a lot of people excited, because if indeed the acoustic hallmarks, but if some of the hallmarks of what would be expected in terms of a communication from a intelligent species like ourselves are showing up in this message, then what we are potentially dealing with, of course, as many hope, is a communication or some form of communication similar to that which humans might utilize in what would be called, of course, active SETI or METI. Now, Stephen Hawking has already come up in the conversation, and I think that, you know, this is often quoted with regard to him. Hawking is a famous, he's actually, in terms of the SETI community, he is famous somewhat for his dismay at the notion of METI or active SETI. He doesn't really condone this kind of activity, and in fact he says that it could be very dangerous if humans ever involve themselves in literally broadcasting messages and broadcasting to potentially hostile extraterrestrial presences elsewhere in the universe that we are down here on Earth. Hey, we're right here. Come check us out. And he argues that this literally could make us sitting ducks for a potentially devastating kind of contact, not the take us to your leader and let us, you know, become space brothers kind that we see in some of the films and things like that, but instead maybe something that would involve, you know, a kind of colonialist occupation of Earth by an extraterrestrial species. Hawking says it's very dangerous to try and toy around with that, and maybe we shouldn't advertise ourselves. And in terms of the notion of what we call the great silence, while we don't see much evidence of communications from deep space from other civilizations, maybe they're thinking the same thing. We're all a little too scared to make that first step. But if indeed this, as it appears to be, which is quite promising, if this appears to be, and there is indeed anything that could be determined with regard to the origins of this radio message that has been received at Arecibo on, I believe, three occasions now. And I think, Chris, they've said that the length of the total length of all three together of these bursts of radio frequency, they're actually less than a minute in totality, right?
Well, altogether they equal right about a minute.
Right about a minute. And so they say that the brevity of these radio transmissions makes them difficult to determine a whole lot about. And in other words, there's not a steady, you know, frequent directed message that they can kind of, you know, latch on to and try and discover a whole lot about indeed where it is coming from. Now, there are a few websites that are talking about this. We'll have some of the links put up at grayleyreport.com so that you can follow up on that yourself and see exactly what others are saying about this. I find it very interesting, and I haven't had my hopes very high with regard to the future of the SETI program for very long. As a matter of fact, actually, as long as I've been aware of SETI, I've pretty much, which I think has been most of my life, I've been aware of the kind of controversy that people, I believe Stanton Friedman is one of the big critics in the UFO community, but there are others, and they all kind of say that, really using radio frequencies or the hope of being able to discover evidence of radio frequencies used for similar purposes is kind of outdated. And if indeed there were some sort of an advanced civilization, perhaps one that is more advanced than we humans are, it would be unlikely that they would be utilizing something as primitive as radio frequencies for those kind of communications. So there are a lot of people who criticize SETI and say that really it's not going to amount to a whole lot. I know that SETI programs have lost a lot of funding over the years, and most of the existing installations like Arecibo that are still engaged actively in this kind of thing are, if I understand correctly, they're primarily funded privately, and these are endeavors that are undertaken, you know, outside of, you know, the scope of governmental projects and things like that. So there's not quite as much involvement on the large scale as there once was with SETI. And then there are also a few of these instances where there are groups and organizations. There was a group in Australia who a couple of years ago made headlines. If I remember correctly, they had hoped to try and institute the use of laser optics and things like this instead of radio transmissions. And therefore, they had, of course, hoped that they might be able to utilize something that might have a little bit more intellectual and technological success than the old tried and true radio frequencies that are so concomitant with SETI.
I just got to be honest, though. I think I'm on the side of Stephen Hawking here, because I think
does it concern you?
A little bit. I think it does, because I mean, as a culture and technologically, as a race, if we are communicating with someone who's flying around through the stars and black holes and whatever, we are severely primitive. And the fact is that any communication by us, we've talked about it on the show before, the perceptions of what's, communication between two species, even here on the planet, can be misinterpreted.
Right, yeah.
And so, somebody flashing some lights out into the stars or, sending a couple radio frequencies could be perceived as hostile, even if they're not meant to be.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have a universal language, even with, the animals and everything on our planet.
Some have argued that the closest we actually do have to a form of universal language would be mathematics. Yes, the use of numbers and equations and things like that. But, I would say that although that might very well be the case, and that mathematics may be the closest hope we would have in terms of having some sort of a uniform, universal system that we can utilize for purposes of communication, by the same token, I think that part of the problem with, again, what we perceive as the great silence is that there's a startling lack of evidence of extraterrestrial civilizations. Now, I know a lot of people, again, are going to look at UFOs and say, hello, lack of evidence that we're being, that contact is being made. But even in the event that UFO phenomenon represented extraterrestrials, I would argue this. And again, I'm not a staunch proponent of the idea that UFOs and extraterrestrials are two concepts that are must remain interconnected, okay, that are linked to one another with certainty, because honestly, we don't know that. I think that probably in truth, the fairest thing to say about UFO phenomena, there are two things that are fair to say. One, there's very little that we know aside from peripheral observations that have been made over the years, and that constitutes a lot of information, but I think that it's still vague enough, that information, that we are still leaping to a lot of conclusions. And then the other thing too that can be said is that UFO phenomena, in all truth, probably is comprised by a lot of different kinds of phenomena. Some earthbound terrestrial aircraft, some, maybe even physical anomalies and interdimensional phenomenon, things like that. There's the potential for some extraterrestrial visitation and things like that. And then there could be other things. Misidentification of known craft is something that has to be factored in as well. And all these things together constitute the broader, what falls under the term UFO or ufology. And therefore, what we have to remember about UFOs is that, with the lack of certainty that we have, I think that, it's of course ripe for speculation. And I'm not one, I'm always preaching about this. I think that, especially when it comes to scientific endeavors, when we're faced with a lack of information, sometimes speculation is the only way that we can begin to kind of nudge ourselves in a direction that's going to lead us towards something that might be conducive to thinking abstractly enough about the problem so that we can come to a new determination or a new element of truth that can be used in furthering our knowledge base with regard to that phenomenon. I think UFOs are like that. We have to engage in some careful, reasonable speculation in order to make the next step, because apparently there is indeed and has been for many decades a lack of evidence that we could utilize otherwise for those kind of purposes.
And that's exactly the problem, is as much as someone may want to consider themselves a child of the universe or whatever.
Right.
The thing is we can only still perceive things terrestrially and predict things with the terrestrial knowledge we've gained throughout our lives. Even, the greatest scientist in the world can only do that because this is all we know, really. We haven't been light years away from the planet Earth. And so trying to perceive something extraterrestrial by terrestrial means is just ludicrous.
It's difficult, and this is where it gets interesting. Exactly what you said right there, Matt. Good point, because I think that part of the whole notion of the great silence, this lack of evidence, again, because the whole point I was trying to make, you know, coming around to talking about UFOs, is that I'm saying that there's a lack of evidence that there is has been contact with, you know, humankind from an extraterrestrial presence. A lot of people would say, hello, UFOs, obviously. That could be the case, but we don't have evidence that states without question that extraterrestrials are behind the UFO phenomenon. Now, that said, okay, if we accept that, while it may represent extraterrestrial phenomena in various shapes and forms, we don't have evidence otherwise that there are communications from deep space, you know, signals and communications along those lines that are being sent along with intention of someone else like ourselves finding those. But what if the case is that what we're actually looking for, okay, is something that is much like ourselves, but other life in the universe is not what we would expect that life to be like? In other words, we're looking for something so similar to humans. We're kind of projecting our own, you know, anthropomorphism into the equation, and we're expecting that there's going to be another human-like species or civilization out there. But what if life elsewhere in the universe has evolved so vastly different from that here on Earth that indeed they wouldn't attempt to communicate with us by means that, in terms of their technology, are similar enough that they would even be recognized by us? These are things that have to be taken into consideration.
Yeah, exactly. We always picture, you know, little green men.
Men.
People even, you know, even the most out there imaginings, like those of H.R. Geiger with Alien, you know, they're still insectoid. It's still based on our terrestrial knowledge.
Yes, exactly. What we recognize as being life here on Earth. Chris, earlier today, you know, when we were doing show prep, we were talking about this new film. Speaking of H.R. Geiger, you know, Ridley Scott's new film, Prometheus, which is going to be coming out, I think, in June. Is that right? I think it's June.
Yeah, thereabouts.
I'm really excited about this film, and I'll tell you why. Because, I mean, I was a big fan of the first Alien film, you know. I was talking with my brother Caleb last night about this, and he says, you know, I wasn't a huge fan of the Alien films. And you said that, Chris, you said you liked the second film better.
Yeah, I preferred Aliens to Alien.
I thought, yeah, you know, the first one, though, was the one that really had the atmosphere, the one that I really liked. And that atmosphere, you know, the first Alien film to me was like the golden era.
Well, see, Alien itself isn't even counted as a sci-fi movie. Like,
it's a horror film.
Yeah, it's a horror film.
Sci-fi horror, yes.
Well, no, it's classified as a horror movie set in space. Mm-hmm. And Aliens and the other ones that don't count are sci-fi flicks.
Okay, yeah. I see. Yeah. And again, coming back to the suspense element, you know, Chris, I would agree with you about that. Maybe that's why it's my favorite, because, you know, I'm a horror film fan, man. I love, you know, the creatures, the bumps in the night and the things like that, you know. And Alien, that scene right there at the end where Ripley gets off, you know, the she gets away from the primary ship and she's in the little pod and she thinks she's escaped and she's, you know, she's disrobing and then she finds out the thing is on the pod with her.
You just like her in her underwear.
Well, no, I mean, come on, I'm a guy, but no, I'm talking about, like, that scene, you know, if there's one thing in the universe that is terrifying truly to me, can you guess what it is? What scares me more than anything? Even though we're in a bunker hundreds of miles beneath the Earth's surface.
Steam?
Men in Black?
No, I'll tell you what.
Sigourney Weaver in her underwear?
Close, close, keep trying.
Aliens?
Getting sucked out
I'm
into space?
I'm obviously terrified by... No.
Suspended animation?
Claustrophobia.
Oh.
The claustrophobic element in that scene where she's on the ship and the thing is tucked away in that little hole and she sees it move and it's like, oh my God. Here she thinks she's escaped. She's on the pod and the thing is on the ship with her. Now, of course, that's all film, you know, but the thing is that what I loved about that film was the atmospheric element. And then, of course, we were talking about how also earlier in the film, there's that point where they, you know, where they touch down, they go down into that cave thing where all the aliens are, and they run into this
spaceship.
It was a spaceship, right? Yeah. They go down in that area there, that cave-like, you know, area within that ship, I guess, and there was this individual, this entity, sort of. It wasn't alive. It was called, what was it, the Space Jockey?
It was the Space Jockey, yeah.
Yeah, and this is supposedly the impetus for this new film, Prometheus. But now, here's what's really neat about the film and why I bring it up. Digging around, because I'm interested in the film, and I like, you know, really Scott's, you know, directorial prowess. I preferred the first Alien film to the sequels by far. In fact, I've never really cared for the sequels at all, but that first one, again, I think is one of the best horror films of all time. But they say that that this new film, Prometheus, although it is being interpreted by some as sort of a prequel to the Alien movies, it really kind of has its own thing going on. It does involve, as I understand, the space jockey, correct?
Yeah, the only thing they've really said about it is that it's going to explain the origin of the space jockey.
The space jockey.
That's like it.
Which, guys, again, what exactly was the space jockey, or what are we interpreting that to have been?
All you really know, and Ridley... Apparently, Ridley Scott had wanted to do a film about it years and years and years ago when he first put out Alien. But he had come up with a whole backstory for the thing. But the only thing you know in the original film is that it's just this very decayed-looking alien with its chest broken open sitting in the spaceship. And it's, you know, way bigger than any human.
Yeah, it's much larger. And what's interesting is that in an interview about this film, Prometheus, Ridley Scott actually had said that part of the inspiration for this film was the work of Eric von Daniken. Eric von Daniken, of course, who is going to be at the Paradigm Symposium in October. You know, if you come out to our event, you're going to actually get to hear... you know, von Daniken hasn't spoken in the United States in years. And I'll just tell you this. I don't want to come across as a credulous-sounding individual. I'm sure there are people who are out there listening to this who are rolling their eyes because I mentioned Eric von Daniken. Yes, there have been instances in the past. If you go to his Wikipedia page, I mean, you'll read that... Yes, some of Eric von Daniken's, you know, evidence that he has used in his books and things like that has been not only questionable, but has also been found to be completely and entirely inaccurate. He's been, you know, brought to question about this, of course, and he has said on various occasions that indeed there were times where he even brought certain quote-unquote evidence to the forefront in his books and things like that because he thought that if he didn't utilize such absolutely, you know, ridiculous material, supporting material, that people wouldn't buy what the deeper concept he was trying to put out there altogether. So he's gotten a lot of criticism for that sort of thing. But I think that really what we have to understand about Eric von Daniken and appreciate about him is that he is the guy who really brought to, you know, a popular medium this notion of paleo contact, or whether or not you buy the idea of ancient aliens literally, you know, manipulating our species, humankind. He's the person who is credited with this, you know, this popular idea in society today that indeed there may have been something going on in ancient times that was not entirely an interaction with, you know, just different people influencing one another and humankind evolving here on Earth. Now, it's viewed by the scientific community as largely pseudoscientific, but then again, I would say that to Mr. von Daniken's credit, most of what we discuss on this program, although we try and approach it fairly skeptically, I think most of the material and the subject matter that we discuss on this program is also interpreted as being pseudoscience. Most of the scientific community looks at the UFO enigma and they'll refer to this as pseudoscientific and say that there's no evidence for it. Again, I think... it was our good friend Red Pill Junkie, who is in the chat room with us this evening, who pointed out that there's a difference between evidence and proof. Well, we don't have proof of a lot of these sorts of things, like UFOs. You can't deny, and I'm always talking about this, I'll preach about it until I'm blue in the face, you can't deny that there is evidence supporting something. And some of the claims of Eric von Daniken also have their evidence and their merit just as well. And so, therefore, I found it very interesting that this idea of some sort of an ancient interaction with an extraterrestrial or otherwise non-human intelligence played into the storyline in this Prometheus. And therefore, I'm very much looking forward to this film. It'll be out this June, and of course, Eric von Daniken. Maybe we can talk to him about that at Paradigm Symposium. That said, I'm Micah Hanks. More on this and other strange news right after this on the Graylin Report.
Hey guys, Jamie Havoc in here for UFO Mag. Do you want to receive the best writing there is in ufology, the best writers, editors, and flat out the best magazine that ufology can offer? If so, I highly recommend UFO Magazine. You can check it out at ufomag.com. And if you mention that you heard this on radio, you can get 6 issues for $19.95. Check it out, ufomag.com. Don't miss out. And keep up to date on the hottest topics in ufology. For UFO Mag, this is Jamie Havkin.
Greetings, space brothers, and welcome back to the program. It is the Grayling Report. I'm Micah Hanks, keeping you company every Tuesday night from 8 to 11 with our fantastic in-studio staff, producer Chris Hayes and engineer Matt Oakley, pushing all the right buttons, making us sound good, better than usual, perhaps. And, of course, we're discussing a host of strange discussions. My very favorite subject, in fact, whether or not there is life elsewhere out there. And perhaps more importantly, have we had communication or contact with that life? I think many people would say it's inescapable. It's going to happen. Others would tell you it's already happened. We are staring it in the face. And then there are others who would probably say this is absolute pseudoscience at its very best. Chris, you know, you come from the perspective of a person who, again, you know, you call yourself an atheist, correct?
That is correct.
Okay, but as an atheist, now this is what I want to ask you. As an atheist, there are many atheists, I think even Christopher Hitchens talked about this, ghosts, goblins, aliens, none of that stuff exists any more than the idea of a big man in the sky who sends praises and blessings to those who live a good life, and those who don't, well, they go to hell. Do you think that an atheist approach, an agnostic approach even, or something along those lines, or you know, atheism along with really hardline skepticism has to remove the possibility of extraterrestrial visitation or the potential for ET existence elsewhere in the universe?
No, and I've never been of the opinion that you know, ETs or UFOs or even many of the cryptids don't exist, because those at least can be verified by science, whereas ghosts and goblins and fairies and
ghosts and goblins.
Well, maybe not fairies or goblins, because they could be creatures, but anything spiritual. I define, I guess, things that I don't believe in as things that involve, you know, the spirit, like ghosts, angels, gods, things of that nature.
Mm-hmm.
Divine retribution.
Now, here's a question I have, though. Now, so what is the difference between what we define as spiritual, okay, or non-physical, I assume, and then the physical, and you know, something like an alien or a non-human intelligence? Could there be a non-physical intelligence that nonetheless is non-spiritual? In other words, is there a distinction between the potential for something non-physical but existent, and then something that we would deem spiritual?
Well, yeah, and I never said non-physical. That,
right, I did.
That was all you.
That was me, which is why I'm asking, is there a distinction between non-physical? Could that exist, and if so, would that be apart from what you would deem spiritual?
Yes, like say, an intelligent race that somehow evolves to the point of being, you know, blobs of energy or, you know, digital information even,
mm-hmm.
but not, you know... I don't know.
It's difficult to frame this.
It is.
It really is. This is the kind of conversation that really gets into the realm of being difficult to reconcile with. Because, again, what we're trying to engage in here, Chris, you and I, is exactly what Matt brought up just a few moments ago, is, you know, in terms of trying to think beyond the confines of life as we would expect for it to exist here on planet Earth. This is why in my book, you know, I did an interview with Saul Niblock last night. Actually, he goes by Tom as well. I always like people with a couple of first names, by the way. Those are all, you know, that you've got a professional. And it was a fantastic interview, too. We really enjoyed talking last night on Guilty Pleasures Radio. But that said, we were talking about my book, Magic, Mysticism, and the Molecule. And at one point, Tom asked me, you know, he said, I think he was kind of wanting to know, you know, how UFOs and aliens kind of fit into the scope of the book, which deals primarily with magical practices, mystical arts, and then, of course, the use of entheogenic molecules and things like that to reach altered states of consciousness. And I point out that often in these altered states that people elicit, whether it be through magical practices and mysticism or through the literal use of an entheogenic, that is a God-releasing substance, a hallucinogen, which many native cultures, of course, do quite frequently. If there is indeed some sort of, you know, intelligence, I mean, well, let's actually take it back and frame the circumstances as follows. What if we could speculate that a non-terrestrial type intelligence, I won't say necessarily a life form, because again, when we talk about life forms, we tend to think of, you know, something that's biological, physical, like ourselves, or like an animal or a plant. But when we talk about an intelligence, could an intelligence exist outside of the confines of physicality? And if so, see, we would equate that as being with, you know, something spiritual or godlike or ghostlike, apparitional. We have terms that deal with these sorts of concepts, but then again, those are also kind of linked to these cultural standards that we have for death and the afterlife and the like. What I wonder is, could there be a non-physical intelligence? And Chris, you'd said something that might exist like in an energetic state, but I'm saying even, because that still constitutes physicality in a sense, I'm saying even if you remove the idea of there being some sort of an energetic basis for this intelligence, could there be a way that an intelligence could exist in a way completely removed from physicality and existing in a state that it would only be able to communicate directly with humans when we entered an altered state of consciousness, which would kind of allow a kind of maybe a sort of a rent in space-time or through dimensionality through which we could meet with them on a non-physical level and converse. This sort of circumstance is described often by people who are what, you know, might be popularly called psychonauts, people who have utilized hallucinogenic practices and processes to achieve altered states of consciousness. And again, you guys know that I don't, you know, endorse the recreational use of drugs for those purposes, because I think that that draws away from the potential that we stand to gain in terms of, you know, insight and illumination, whether it be on a spiritual level or literally in terms of understanding the greater notion of what consciousness is and what kinds of intelligence and consciousness, sentient intelligences, could exist elsewhere in the universe. So it's an interesting kind of concept to try and think about. Intelligence, again, I hesitate to use life because I think life is too, in our terminology, concomitant with the notion of a biological being, there being physical mass representative, something you can touch and feel, you know, or smell for that matter. You know, but the thing is that could an intelligence exist apart from that? And if we're talking about what we call quote-unquote alien life, could it be that a species might evolve to a state where they transcend physicality in that sense?
Well, yeah, it's entirely possible, but
I guess anything's possible, really.
To play on what Matt said as far as like how we picture aliens or extraterrestrials, things of that nature, we're bound by our cultural perceptions and what we're used to. So I can say, yes, a non-physical entity, surely that's possible, mm-hmm. but there's no way I could conceptualize what the hell a non-physical entity is.
You would even quantify that.
Yeah.
Exactly. That,
because
that,
you say non-physical, I see immediately, when you said non-physical, I saw a lit cloud.
Yes,
you
exactly.
Know, pulsating.
We can't even conceptualize non-physical, because what in the absence of physicality could there be? That means nothing, right? But see, in science, we have this concept of antimatter, don't we? Don't we have this concept of dark matter, which exists in the absence of where actual matter should be, and this therefore balances the inequalities, you know, that are, you know, persistent throughout the known physical universe? We have no proof of that, but again, this is almost more like an, you know, kind of intellectual property. In a sense, it's an intellectual idea that we have used to fill a void that we cannot come to terms with in terms of reconciling what is really going on a universal level throughout space as we know it. And so this is a fascinating realm that we get into. Matt, I'm sorry, we're about out of time, but you'd want to jump in there. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say that's exactly what I was talking about earlier when I brought up little green men and insectoid aliens. Mm-hmm. Is what if, you know, an extraterrestrial or even another being from another realm or whatever existed on, you know, even a different wavelength that we couldn't perceive.
Like the clockwork elves.
Yeah, you know,
just as an example, that may be a joke, but, you know, everyone who does the DMT trips and, you know, who was, interviewed through Strassman's book said they saw mantis-like people, tiny elves, even... what is that called? It goes around, not a merry-go-round. I mean, that's what it is, but a carousel horse.
Yeah.
Carousel horses being, you know, the dominant life form in the dimension where they went. So I think, again, even though maybe with that DMT you are in fact going to another dimension. You're still, because it's your consciousness going, you're still applying something to make you not go mad. You're applying some kind of thing from your past or from your culture or just anything from your subconscious to give whatever you're seeing or not seeing a form so you can deal with the fact that it's there.
You know,
exactly, like some sorts of, some, you know, types of schizophrenia and things like that, you know, running away from things that could possibly harm you mentally, your brain protecting you from that.
Okay.
I mean, we know people's brains do that.
Well, so. In other words, what people's brains will tend to do is that they will kind of supplant sometimes a troublesome circumstance with a mental image that is intended to replace what they're having to endure. Wheatley Strieber even talked about, you know, during some of his alleged alien abductions, that when he would wake up the following morning, all he would recall would be seeing a owl, literally, that had, you know, landed there on his windowsill, and it would sit there and watch him all night. And I've talked with, you know, in fact, Mike Cleland, our good friend at the Hidden Experience blog. Mike Cleland always talks about how this prevalence of the owl in UFO abductee lore is so curious, and how you can't rule that out. That's fascinating to me as well. Does the mind literally fill in voids for us at times about these sorts of things? We'll discuss that more next on the Grayling Report.
On the battlefield, there's a saying America's military men and women live by. Never leave a fallen warrior behind, ever. Off the battlefield, Wounded Warrior Project operates with the same goal. Wounded Warrior Project was created to help our men and women returning home with the scars of war, whether those scars are physical or mental. Wounded Warrior Project. We never leave a fallen warrior behind, ever. Learn more about what we do at WoundedWarriorProject.org.
Exopolitics. It's beyond the fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Grayling Report with your host, Micah Hanks.
Your home for right and reason in an unreasonable world. Welcome back to the program. It is the Grayling Report. I'm your happy host, the always fairly well-informed host, the guy who always articulates his ideas pretty well, the fellow who always strives for excellence at least 2 out of 3 hours every Tuesday from 8 to 11 p.m. No, I'm kidding. We always strive for excellence in everything we do here at the Grayling Report, and that's why I'm so thankful to have guys like Chris Hayes and Matt Oakley here helping me put this all together. Tuesdays have become, if anything, in Grayling land, a ritual. I had Holly literally not taking any phone calls and putting them through to my office today. I literally was not taking any phone calls except for Scotty Roberts. I took a phone call or two from Scotty Roberts. I always do. And Chris and I actually spoke to Scotty just right before the program tonight. But otherwise, yeah, I wouldn't take any phone calls today.
I thought you were going to say you had Holly sacrifice a potato baby. Because it's become a ritual.
You leave my tots out of this.
Leave the tots. Leave the kids at home.
You know what the best part about dating a Hadal High Priestess is?
What's that, Chris?
Anyone who makes fun of me gets potato magic all over him.
Mashed potatoes, my friends.
Yeah.
That's right. Oh, goodness. You know, there was something I wanted to try and jump into here. I saw in the chat room, Red Pill Junkie writes, Muhammad once asked the angel Gabriel to show his true form. He became a giant with the head above the sky, and Muhammad freaked out and fainted. And you know that
what a wuss.
What that reminds me of. No. You remember The Wind in the Willows? And there's that enigmatic chapter titled "The Piper at the Gates of Dawn," in which Mole and Rat come across, you know, the god Pan, essentially, out in the forest, you know, a nature god, and the entire experience is erased from their memory after it happens because he spares them the horror of having to reconcile with the fact that they'd actually met a nature god. You know, that kind of element is rife throughout different experiences and different religious traditions. Many of the Indian epics also talk about similar things, where if one of the Indian gods or deities came and walked alongside man, he would cause man to forget that they were actually in the presence of the gods, so that they wouldn't be overwhelmed with terror. And so I think that that's interesting, and especially that Red Pill Junkie wrote that in the chat room there, because when we're talking about trying to reconcile with other kinds of intelligence elsewhere in the universe, perhaps those that exist beyond the physical. And then we talk about these experiences where humankind, you know, for instance, I cited Whitley Strieber and his notion of alien beings literally physically abducting him, and then those memories being kind of supplanted with memories, you know, of course, these are entirely constructed memories within his own psyche of seeing an owl. And then the prevalence of the owl throughout the experiences of my friend Mike Clellan, he drew those parallels. Many abductees believe that there are literal physical experiences that are maybe removed from the mind or kind of washed and replaced with these experiences, where a symbolic element from within the subconscious, maybe an owl or some other animal, replaces that experience because it is something that is so difficult for the human mind to understand and to come to terms with, that they're the only way that the mind can continue to interpret reality around that event is to kind of create a block, you know, supplant that memory with something that is more difficult or less difficult to have to come to terms with and reconcile with, so that they can go on in the absence of sheer and ultimate terror and insanity. Now, that's a subject that we're going to address a little bit more this hour, because we're going to take the conversation into the realm of H.P. Lovecraft. But first, I wanted to touch on something else. One of our listeners in the UK, Jerry Brett, emailed me, and I wanted to share this email because it deals with our guest recently, Mr. Philip Coppens, the mighty Philip Coppens, who, again, schedule permitting, he's going to be at the Paradigm Symposium this year with us as well. Can't wait to be able to spend some time one-on-one with Philip Coppens. He's a fantastic researcher, and of course we had him on the program. I'm sure we're going to have him on the program many times in the future here on the Grayling Report. But that said, Jerry wrote, thanks for bringing up the topic of Vimana legitimacy with the author. Of course, Vimanas being the ancient flying craft of the ancient Vedic epics. And of course, I'd mentioned some emails that had come from the listeners that talked about my own interpretation of the legitimacy of Vimanas. Well, Jerry happens to be the fellow who wrote, and he said, I was actually raising my hand from the steering wheel as I was listening, and I said aloud, that was me! So he said, another great piece of radio podcastry by you and your crew. Yeah, it's both. You know, we do broadcast live, but I know that our larger listenership really is the, you know, the group of listeners out there who like to be able to listen on demand and take this with them as they drive in their cars and things like that. And hey, we're thankful that people want to listen in any capacity. So that said, Jerry writes, I think your point was well taken by Philip. It was perhaps the first time I've ever heard Philip pause in an interview and reassess his own point of view on a subject. Using a quote-unquote channeled document as evidence would make one question the legitimacy of a lot of statements made by proponents of the Pan-Vimana Airways hypothesis, and bears out the initial essay and statements of yours that I had questioned. Philip was engaging as ever. I agree totally with you. The hope that Philip does become the go-to guy on the ancient alien and related theories. And with Philip, you get the genuine feel that it is about the study and the investigation of these subjects and not the quote-unquote about-me attitude that several of the other proponents appear to have. My first radio connection, he said, with the Ancient Astronaut Theory actually was hearing his favorite author of the time, who we mentioned last hour as well, Eric von Daniken, being interviewed on LBC Radio in London, England, when he was about probably around 1974, so he was a teenager. This is the fellow writing the email. He said, I actually phoned in and got to speak to Eric, and it was an experience I'm very proud of. A couple of things have been bouncing around the old noggin lately, such as things including Philip's DNA/panspermia hypothesis and his own personal view and belief on the intelligent design of life, the continual reporting of glowing red eyes by witnesses applied to a whole host of cryptozoological and Fortean creatures, and of course the shamanic approach to otherworldly contact and the similarities to the hierarchy within churches and religious institutions, especially the Roman Catholic Church. So he says, if you don't mind, Mike, I would like to bounce them off of you sometime in the future. Well, Jerry, if you're listening now, I'll go ahead and address a few of those. We've talked about some of the shamanic approaches to this sort of thing. And, of course, in terms of, you know, panspermia and DNA and panspermia, of course, referring to kind of what we talked about last hour, ancient astronaut theories and the idea of paleo contact, or maybe even some sort of genetic tampering with the human race. Maybe the actual notion that we as a species, or life in general here on Earth, was planted here by some intelligent race. All these kinds of things. We've touched on some of that tonight, but I want to tie in this element that you've mentioned with red eyes being reported by witnesses applied to things both cryptozoological and Fortean. In fact, a lot of Bigfoot encounters describe red-eyed creatures. A lot of reports of, you know, creatures like Mothman describe a red-eyed creature. A lot of reports of, you know, alien beings will describe this from time to time. In fact, I believe that the alien grays described by Travis Walton also had not large black eyes, but all the large eyes nonetheless, and they were, you know, by all intents and purposes, very similar to the popular grays. But the eyes were red, if I remember correctly. So, what is the reason for this red-eyed imagery, the prevalence of the red eyes throughout strange phenomena? Again, I think that in a sense that could come down to symbolism, and that isn't to say by any means that the majority of the phenomena being witnessed is not real or is otherwise imaginary. But I do think that, Matt, you know, this is something that you were saying last hour, that sometimes, and again, coming down, I think, to the idea of the way that the human mind interprets different phenomena. What if, for instance, the singular phenomena itself were something that were from another realm, another dimensional state, something existing in this state as, well, again, the best we could hope to try and define it as being would be non-physical. Intelligence, sentient intelligence existing in the absence of physicality. When we see that, When we perceive what appears to be something communicating with us, or when we experience this experience of some sort of interaction or communication in the absence of what we would deem a physical three-dimensional biological being or entity or presence otherwise, is it possible that the human mind supplants elements of that experience and creates a physical being from the memory? For instance, let's look at something like, you know, the famous 1973 abduction of Charles Hickson and Calvin Parker. Okay, they are abducted from Pascagoula, Mississippi. They're sitting on a dock. They're fishing at night. A blue light is seen in the sky. An egg-shaped metallic object comes down, and these elephant-skinned, one-legged things with carrots for noses come off the ship and take them on board and do all kinds of weird stuff to them. They examine them. An eyeball-like, football-sized thing scans their bodies and looks them over and then brings them back down, and they're both terrified after what has happened. What if, let's just speculate, what if that experience was not entirely physical? What if, indeed, there was some sort of an occurrence that would have allowed a non-physical intelligence to enter the minds of these two men? And what if, in terms of trying to reconcile with what they experienced, their minds put together a series of symbolism, you know, or a series of symbols, rather, you know, or a series of elements that draw from a sort of archetypal symbolism that exists within the mind, and as a result, they are left with the perception of some physical experience, and that indeed what actually happened may not have been, you know, it may not have been physical entirely or at all. Now, if that were the case, what we might expect would be that the stories changed. And, of course, what we know is that Parker and Hickson's stories were remarkably consistent with one another, and they were genuinely terrified. In fact, at one point they were in an interrogation room at the police department following their experience, their alleged abduction. And the two men did not know they were being recorded, but the recorded conversation shows that Hickson was, you know, pacing around the room and that the two men were talking, and that Parker was literally losing his mind. He was a young man. I think he may have just been, if not a teenager, in his early 20s at the time, badly frightened. and was just literally was saying over and over again, "Oh God, I know there's a God. I know that there's a God up there." They were terrified. But the similarities between their experience, while consistent at the time, did begin to kind of break away and move apart from one another after a fashion much later on. And what I mean by that is that, indeed, later on, Hickson did begin to say that the aliens, what he perceived as being these grotesque-looking humanoids, sort of almost humanoid, they kind of were, there were anthropomorphic elements to them, but in other ways they weren't quite human-like or anthropomorphic. Later on, his description of what happened changed, though. And this is true. Later on, Hickson would go on to say that, in fact, what had actually happened was that there hadn't been gray, you know, elephant-skinned things that had taken them on board a craft, and it hadn't just been this football-shaped eye-looking thing that scanned them. Hickson actually ended up revising a few of his statements and saying that there was a beautiful woman on board that craft, and that she actually used a device that resembled a hypodermic needle, which she actually used to stab him in the genitals with. Okay, yes. Indeed. Brings to mind the line, "Ma'am, if anyone's going to be doing the poking here." But anyway. So that said, no, but in truth, what I'm trying to say is that the circumstances, according to Hickson, later were different. His recollection of the events did change. So does that mean he was lying? Does that mean that he was just trying to make his story sound more sensational? Did he try to revise certain statements so that his abduction would sound more similar to other abduction reports that were coming to the forefront and being covered by the media, you know, which often involve some sort of examination of the reproductive organs and this sort of thing? Did he revise certain statements so that he would fit more into the mythos that was beginning to kind of surround alien abduction stories and things like that? Well, that being said, as opposed to changing the story so that he would fit in more or just being an outright liar, what I would ask is, what if indeed what he perceived as an entirely real and physical experience was partially something that his mind had put in place of a psychological occurrence, not an unreal circumstance, but something, again, that may have taken place? We could even speculate that it was a form of contact with a sentient intelligence, but that this may have happened in his mind in such a way that his mind tried to reconcile with the circumstances by creating an event in the absence of one actually having transpired, and therefore his perception of that event would change and evolve over time along with his own perception of who he was and of what alien abduction was supposed to be. I know that's far out, but who's to say that that's not what's actually happening? The mind works in very mysterious ways, and indeed, what we perceive as being alien abduction may not be entirely physical at all. This and more will be examined on the other side of this break. I'm Micah Hanks. It's the Graylian Report.
Want to have some fun? Maybe get a little bit of insight. Get a lay of the land. Want to know what's really going on? Do what I do. Listen to Future Theater. It airs every Saturday, 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern, on the InceptionRadioNetwork.com. We'll see you there.
As a parent, you can't help but look at your child and wonder what the future holds. You may dream about the possibility of your son or daughter becoming a professional athlete or a renowned heart surgeon. But while you're dreaming, consider this. The odds that your child will be diagnosed with autism are 1 in 110. Knowing the signs of autism and getting an early diagnosis could make a world of difference to your child and to you. To learn the signs, visit AutismSpeaks.org. Brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council.
Take it back. It's my time. regions of Appalachia. It's the Graylian Report with Micah Hanks. To join the program by phone, call 828-398-4886. Skype users can reach the program by calling Skype ID Graylian Report. And now, from hundreds of miles beneath terra firma, in the depths of the hollow earth, live from the Graylian Bunker, it's Micah Hanks.
You know, part of what interests me about the potential for alien life is also life here on Earth that behaves in ways that we don't expect very often. And I think that this is something that, you know, specialists with NASA and other organizations have, expressed might be a good way for us to prepare ourselves for eventual alien contact, is to begin to look for life that exists here on Earth that is a little different from what we're used to. And real quick, actually, I think we've got a news story we're going to get to here in a moment that kind of deals with something like that. But I do want to say we will have the phone lines open if anyone would like to call in and share in the discussion. You can also email us, info@graylianreport.com. Skype will be open, Graylian Report on Skype. And, of course, you can also contact us anytime via text message, 828-367-7201. One of our listeners sent along a text message very nice discussing, let's see here, oh, good old universal love. Nothing creepy. Hey, that's right. Universal love to all our friends out there. And let's just hope that in the event that we receive universal love from aliens, well, that kind of love is the same sort of kinship and camaraderie that we would hope to express to one another here on planet Earth. Not the kind that comes to Earth to devour life as we know it, right?
Yeah, and let's just hope that universal love is consensual.
Yes, indeed, right. Speaking of devouring and life forms devouring things, there's this recent story we've got here about fungus that is capable of, well, devouring plastic.
Yeah, that's correct. This one comes from fastcoexist.com. It's entitled, Fungi Discovered in the Amazon Will Eat Your Plastic.
Eat your plastic. Hide your plastic, folks.
It almost sounds like kind of a threat.
But eat your plastic.
Stand back, boys. Wow, that was the deepest.
That's
I think.
That's horrifying.
Yeah, I've never heard. Anyway, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Chris.
Anyway, we all know that the Amazon's home to more species than anywhere else on Earth, with many more still to be discovered. Mm-hmm. Well, it's time you guys have been introduced to the newest offering. It's a fungus that eats and thrives on plastic in a nearly airless landfill.
Mm.
Yeah, gross. this year, the students with Yale's annual Rainforest Expedition and Laboratory discovered and cultivated a fungus that was entirely new to the scientific world. It also devours and gains sustenance from polyurethane plastics. You know polyurethane. Your garden hose is made from it. Your styrofoam cups and coolers are made from it. Okay, fine. A vast majority of consumer-grade products that have plastic in them are made either from or with it.
There's no escaping it, then.
No. No. And you can't... That's why we use those canvas bags when we go to the grocery store now.
Exactly.
Because we get those dirty glares if we get plastic bags. Sometimes, though, and this is a little secret, sometimes when I'm feeling a little squirrely, and you know, there are people around, like...
Uh-oh. I don't think I like where this is going.
This is,
No, it's not kinky. You know, everyone's got their little canvas bags. And normally, I've got them. I usually keep them in my car. Sometimes I don't, though, when, you know, I go grocery shopping and take them in. I forget to bring them back out. Sometimes, if I'm feeling a little squirrely, because I end up reusing those damn plastic bags anyway, I ask for it to be double-bagged, even if it's, like, an apple... Just
especially at the like natural foods.
Oh, yeah.
Or, you know
and just to see the looks on people's faces, because, you know, you have no idea what I'm doing with those bags. I could be turning them into rubber bouncy balls for babies.
Yeah, no, that's what I'm wondering. I was going to say, where are we going with this, Chris?
I mean, I just want to say that people are jerks sometimes when you go to the grocery store.
I was going to say, I still don't know that I'm following you 100%, but...
Sometimes I double bag things to make other people angry. It's a fun thing I do sometimes.
Oh, you're just messing with people. You're
yes.
playing psychological
yes.
games.
But anyway, digressions aside, I'm sure you also remember hearing that all of those plastic grocery bags that you don't use anymore, also made from polyurethane, will be sitting in the landfill long after your children's children are dead. Hopefully that won't be the case for long, though. The fungi that was found, it's a Pestalidiopsis microspora. Again, for people who don't like Latin, it's Pestalidiopsis microspora. Has been observed to break down polyurethane and turn the resulting components into food. The real kicker, though, is that the little powerhouse does it all in an anaerobic environment. And I know everyone knows an anaerobic environment is an environment devoid of oxygen.
Come on!
Much like the conditions found at the bottom of landfills. What does this mean? What does it mean?
What does it mean, actually?
Well, what it means is, right now, not much. But it certainly looks promising for the for future research and applications. You know, right now, they don't have a lot of it. They don't want to take a whole lot of it from the rainforest in the event that it either destroys our ecosystem or we mess up and kill it. And then there's no more of it. But maybe they'll even come up with a version of the fungus for home usage.
Mm-hmm. That's going to be interesting. So, in other words, is this going to be one of those instances where in the future technology will outsource certain processes to biological organisms for purposes of, for instance, you know, breaking down plastics so that they're not, you know, left, you know, in some landfill or something like that for thousands and thousands of years? Because, I mean, again, I think that's one of the big concerns about a lot of these plastics and things like that is that they are not, what exactly is the general biodegradable nature of plastic. I know that ideally, you know, the whole idea is to try and with green technology make everything biodegradable. You throw it on the ground, and you know, within a few weeks or at very most a few months, it's going to be completely broken down. You know, absorbed and taken back into the earth. A lot of plastics, you know, can last for years and years and years and years, as well as, you know, metal, you know, and things like that. You find old aluminum cans from the 1970s if you go on hikes, and you'll find these old, you know, antiquated looking, you know, beer and soda cans that are lying around, and they'll just stay there forever and ever. You know, even though that rust and these natural processes, when exposure to moisture and things like this occur, they're going to stay there for a long time. And so the idea is to try and get things to become more naturally biodegradable. But I guess in the instance where there is something along these lines, a fungus that literally consumes plastic in such a way, the hope would be to be able to kind of speed that process along in such a way that would be more friendly to the environment, where otherwise natural processes might not be able to do so on their own.
I still say we ought to launch it all into the sun.
Launch it all into the sun. Yeah, launch all our trash and everything like that into the sun.
And just so you guys know, there's really no definitive answer on how long does plastic take to break down. It only says depending on the specific type of plastic as well as the environment that it's in, is how long it's going to take. Exposure to direct sunlight helps speed up the process. And plastics never actually decompose. They merely break down into smaller and smaller pieces. Being an inorganic material, it will never compost.
Ah, yes, exactly. So that's the big concern right there. Unless, of course, it is consumed by some other organism, which is what Chris is discussing there. Yeah, speaking of other kinds of organisms, let's say we've talked on alien life. We've touched on, well, what might be likened to something from either an alien story or maybe even a horror film, as Chris has described there. But, you know, there's this other hope for the discovery of new kinds of life that's occurring elsewhere. This story was touched on by the Washington Post this week that described Russians who are now drilling into a previously untouched lake known as Lake Vostok below the Antarctic Glacier. Now, of course, the general idea here is that these Russian scientists have drilled into this very dark and never-before-touched lake, 2.2 miles below the surface of Antarctica. I wonder if there's a bunker down in there somewhere. And this state-run Russian news agency reported this on Monday. Yesterday, according to the news source, our scientists stopped drilling at the depth of 3,768 meters and reached the surface of the subglacial lake, the news agency quoted. The team had finally managed to pierce the ice sheet into Vostok. The report could not be verified Monday, but numerous Antarctica experts in the United States said that they'd been hearing the same unconfirmed news. Now, an official at the Russian Arctic and Antarctic Scientific Research Institute in St. Petersburg said Tuesday that a formal announcement would be coming out of Prime Minister Vladimir Putin's office and that it was expected to be made soon. It has taken, apparently, the Russians more than 20 years to drill into the lake, operating in some of the most brutal weather conditions in the world. Their reported accomplishment comes just as the Antarctic summer ends at Vostok, and the cold becomes so great that machinery can't be operated and airplanes can't even come and go to reach the region. But now, one of our listeners emailed a different perspective on this story, something a little bit different. And we wanted to try and take this kind of an approach to the study. Again, if we're going to talk about speculation and alien life and all this kind of weird stuff, let's just go ahead and take it all the way over into the realm of science fiction, because I think it's very interesting sometimes looking at the way that certain subjects are brought to the forefront in science fiction. Excuse me. And then they also end up coming to pass maybe a little later in real life. Think about Arthur C. Clarke and the predictions made in his fiction with regard to things like radio telecommunication satellites. Or think about, for instance, you know, some of the predictions made in the science fiction of Werner Vinge, who is not only a science fiction author, but a mathematician credited with the modern concept of a future intelligence explosion along the lines of a singularity. He coined that term, singularity. You know, we hear about all different kinds of other predictions that are made in the science fiction of various writers. And who knows what exactly the circumstances are here, whether it is the chicken that comes first or the egg. Do these science fiction authors imagine strange things, and that this is, of course, where the inspiration for future innovation draws from? Or is it that they are so good at their visioning, you know, future technology that the inevitable creation of similar technology comes along later? You remember that scene in 2001? And the general, I can't remember his name, but the fellow, he's gone to the Clavius moon base, and he steps into that little booth and he's having that video conference with his little daughter, who says she wants a Bush baby. You know, think about how futuristic that must have looked in, I think, what was it, 1968, 1969, when that film came out in theaters?
Yeah, somewhere around there.
And now look today how we can all get onto our computers and we can literally take a Skype phone call. I was having a Skype conference with Scotty Roberts talking about, you know, we were doing some planning late last night after this radio interview I did where we were talking about Paradigm Symposium. And I'm sitting here in my office talking with Scotty, and he's sitting there in his office, and his wife's sitting there, and we're having this conversation, and I feel like I'm sitting there in his office with him chatting. We got this video feed. It's incredible, the kind of technology that we have available to us, and it's so commonplace now. Everybody uses Skype, you know. I people who have family members that are overseas and in the military and things like that are able to stay in touch with family members, and you speak to them in real time with a video conferencing a technology that is made available to people for free if they have a computer and if they have an internet connection, you know, with a fairly decent, you know, connection speed. And when we saw this for the first time in a film like 2001 A Space Odyssey, it seemed really far out, didn't it? If not impossible. And now it's commonplace today. The point I'm making here, and what I'm getting around to, is that every now and then when we read about complex ideas and futuristic things, oh, Haywood Floyd was the name of the fellow in 2001, I believe. Yeah, Red Pill Junkie put that up in the chat room there for us. But the point I'm trying to get around to here is that fiction, you'll find that when you go back and you look at fiction from a few decades ago, you'll often find very interesting parallels to existing technology of today. And whether or not these individuals were inspiring these kind of innovations, or if they were predicting those kinds of innovations, is the question of the hour. But in the case of one well-known science fiction and horror writer, I think it is quite clear that in most cases what he described bordered more along creepy predictions. And of course, I'm discussing none other than Howard Phillips Lovecraft, H.P. Lovecraft. One of our listeners wrote this week. He said, "Hi guys, I love the show. Just a quick email, wondering if you've noticed the connection to recent news events and H.P. Lovecraft's At the Mountains of Madness." And he linked to the story about Russians drilling into this previously untouched Lake Vostok below Antarctic Glacier. Or, you know, again, they're not going to be able to stay, you know, on this project for much longer with the Antarctic summer coming to an end. It's going to become probably very difficult to even access that region. And they're probably going to hope to, having reached the lake, which is, you know, well underneath the surface, the ground level surface there in Antarctica, they're going to probably hope to get some water samples and something like that. And who knows if there's indeed life perhaps under this lake there beneath the Antarctic glacier. But Mark, who wrote in this email, he said, you know, in the story, Lovecraft gave a probable position, and he named latitude and longitude, placing the location where this takes place in the story only 113 miles from possible new life that may actually now be found to exist in the Antarctic. And Mark writes, "I've had some sightings myself over the years, and it's changed my own mode of thinking. I believe there's a numbing for want of a better term, by the mass media and news agencies, and even scientists, the latter of whom are driven by the other two. Well, Mark attached a Google Earth image for us. He said, I hope it works, but this is my first time I've attempted sending a screenshot. And anyway, keep asking the questions. Thanks, Mark. What he was getting around to was this story of At the Mountains of Madness by H.P. Lovecraft, in which two researchers who are in the Antarctic actually discover not only the remnants of these strange life forms, but also they go into this kind of underground area where there are these blind, huge penguins walking around. And they actually find this great big black bubbling mass. And this thing, apparently this whatever it is, feeds on these large, blind, subterranean penguins. Or subterranean penguins. And so the story is pretty strange. And as they're leaving, the two guys, they escape from this cave. And as they're leaving, one of them glances back over this mountain range below this area that they'd been into. And he sees something in the distance, something that exists over there. And it's so incredible that it literally goes insane. It drives him to madness, whatever he sees. And he never talks about it. He won't say what it is that he's seen. This was a popular motif used throughout the work and the fiction of H.P. Lovecraft. He loved to try and describe the indescribable. And in doing so, he would often, you know, leave a lot of unseen elements that were, you know, kind of left in, you know, to the reader and to the reader's imagination for further interpretation. But that said, the idea of finding life underground in Antarctica is indeed fairly similar to the idea expressed in the story At the Mountains of Madness by H.P. Lovecraft. Now that might be a bit of a stretch in terms of drawing a parallel between the similarity of those stories if it weren't for the fact that Lovecraft on many occasions has seemed to be able to do this sort of thing where he has come up with really far out ideas that decades later seem to have some sort of relevance to actual events that would come to transpire. One example of this, guys, remember we talked on the program a while back, and I've written about this many times too, a strange sound that was recorded back in the 1990s by NOAA. It was bloop.
Bloop.
Yes, this strange noise that was recorded deep beneath the, you know, from some location out there in the Pacific Ocean. And the story was that the National the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration had been utilizing Cold War era hydrophones. In other words, they were microphones that were mounted in different locations deep, deep, deep beneath the ocean. Now, these had initially been utilized for tracking, you know, submarines and things like that during the Cold War years, but These hydrophones were later utilized for monitoring different things, you know, seismic activity and other, you know, sounds that could be recorded in a portion deep within the Pacific Ocean known as the Deep Sound Channel, where the pressure is conducive to allowing sound to travel for great distances. Well, anyway, these hydrophones managed to record a number of strange noises. I think it was during the summer of 1997, if I remember correctly. And some of these noises could be attributed to things like volcanic activity. You know, some of them even could be attributed to cruise ships and things like that. A few maybe would have been attributed to submarines and other vessels that might be moving beneath the ocean. Some of them were less easily explained. And they were given very funny names, like Gregorian chant, slow down, and of course, bloop. Now, bloop was interesting, and following that story, I actually, when I talk about the story, a lot of people are like, okay, there was a weird sound recorded, well, what's there to make of it? That sound actually caused a lot of controversy, and after the initial report with the different positions from the scientific community with regard to what exactly that noise may have been, which I'll get to in a moment, after that story came out, years after the fact, I interviewed Chris Fox of NOAA and a few of the other folks, and ask them exactly what their feelings were about the sound and what it was, what it actually might have been. Because, and this is where it gets really strange, there were, again, conflicting opinions as to what exactly bloop was, but some people, certain marine biologists, were actually out there saying that they thought that whatever this thing was, that it was biological in origin, that the bloop noise, which if you get on Wikipedia and you look up bloop, you'll actually have the little sound bite. And when you hear the thing, it just sounds, you know, just sounds like a bubble, you know, bubbling up underwater. Bloop. But that sound, you have to keep in mind, to be able to be audible in that format, had to be sped up about 16 times. And the bloop noise, many said, actually seemed to be some kind of noise that may have been biological in origin. If it were some kind of an animal that had made this noise, they said that this thing would had to have been larger than a blue whale. But what could possibly exist out there in our oceans that is actually larger than a blue whale? That's a haunting mystery that has lingered for a number of years. Now, the thing is that, to be fair, although there were some marine biologists, I think Paul Lobel may have been one of them, there were others who said that they didn't think that there was a biological source for the bloop noise. But whatever the case may be, in terms of wherever this strange sound seemed to originate from, there is a location, and I believe actually the name of this is the Oceanic Point of Inaccessibility. I believe that's the proper term for this. There is a location in the Pacific Ocean that is furthest from any land in any direction that you can get within a large body of oceanic water anywhere on planet Earth, okay? It's out in the South Pacific, and at that point out there in the middle of the ocean, you are further than you can be anywhere else in the world's oceans from land in any direction. From that rough location is where this bloop sound seemed to emanate. And in the story written by H.P. Lovecraft, known as The Call of Cthulhu, indeed, the location for the sunken city of R'lyeh, which is where Cthulhu is awakened from at the story's climax, this is actually the same location from which the bloop sound seemed to originate. So think about this, and this is very strange. We have this location as far as you can get from land in any direction, out in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, and this is roughly where this strange noise that was recorded by NOAA back in the 1990s using deep-sea moored hydrophones. Okay, this strange noise emanates from someplace out there in the ocean, and then we look back to the fiction, okay, just the science fiction, the crazy meanderings of the mind of one writer who decades ago happened to make this the location for his Cthulhu creature. And the sunken city where the dead Cthulhu waits dreaming. The slimy elder god, you know. And so I thought that was always very interesting that there would be that tie-in. But that, again, is not the only time that H.P. Lovecraft managed to tap into these weird parallels to real-world events. Another story. Here's another example. There was this story that he wrote. It was a very short story. The entire thing, I mean, most of Lovecraft's stuff, if you're not familiar with H.P. Lovecraft, you know, I can't recommend it enough. If you like the sort of thing that we talk about on this program, weird stuff, you're interested in science fiction and just real kind of weird, creepy, dark fiction, but not like of the kind that just makes you sick, you know, not like what you see in the Saw movies. I don't like horror movies, you know, that are made these days quite so much as, you know, the old kind of horror movies, you know, that dealt with monsters and things like that, you know. Terror to modern audiences seems to be, you know, serial killers and just stuff that grosses you out, you know. And I'm just not as drawn to the genre as I used to be for that very reason.
Older's the best, man.
Yeah.
Did you know there was a movie made back in the, I believe it was either late 60s or early 70s, Italian film. Terrifying movie. And I hear that the last 12, there's only one thing that's more scary than the last 12 minutes of Suspiria.
Oh, what was that?
And that's the first 88.
But, you know, actually, Suspiria happens to be a favorite film of mine,
oh,
too.
Yeah.
You know, I'll tell you, Joan Bennett, who played Elizabeth Stoddard on Dark Shadows, you know, that was, I think, her last film role, and I'm a big fan of Joan Bennett. I think she was, you know, wonderful actress. And you know, to be as well-respected in Hollywood as Joan Bennett was, I also have always been told she was really nice to people, too, so that's kind of cool. But, yeah, you know, getting back to the idea of the way that you know, horror movies are you know, in you know, how that genre is presented in the modern day, I'm you know, outright turned off by it in a lot of instances, and I have high hopes for this Prometheus film, but you know, we'll see how that goes. I'll just say this: George Lucas did great with the first three Star Wars films, and then he came back and decided to finish the series, and I think he blew it. You know, hopefully, Mr.
Show of hands.
Yeah, right. Exactly. I think it'll be unanimous here, and among a lot of the listenership, everybody going to be racing out right this weekend to see the Phantom Menace in 3D, right?
Nope, not me. Not me.
I very nearly smacked you.
A good thing, like, Chris is sitting across from me over there. Nanny boo, but you can't reach me.
Oh, but I have wine.
Oh, don't do it. Don't do it. Well, listen, I'll tell you this, though. That said, the kind of stories and the kind of approach to weird fiction that H.P. Lovecraft featured in his stories, that's the kind of thing that I like. It was mind-expanding. It made you think about things in a kind of backwards way. H.P. Lovecraft made you think about horror and weird science fiction stuff like a wizard must think when he's casting a spell. Backward, twisted thoughts, you know, that kind of thing. And that's what I like about H.P. Lovecraft's fiction.
And I was actually going to tell you, I was going to bring this up. We had briefly talked about it before the show when we were talking about the latest H.P. Lovecraft at the Mountains of Madness correlation.
Which they are making a film of that, right?
I'm actually not sure. I hadn't heard anything about
that. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, from what I understand, I don't think it's in production yet. I think it's still in pre-production, yeah. But it's supposed to be directed by Guillermo del Toro.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, and I've heard that there have been all these different hiccups and things, but hopefully that project will get off the ground. And there have been some good film representations of Lovecraft films made in the past. One of them happens to be the film From Beyond, which is probably one of my very favorite. And I'll tell you what, From Beyond may be one of the best examples, literally one of the very best examples I can think of in terms of how Lovecraft's fiction actually mirrored what starts to play over into real life and how he seemed to predict some of these elements years and years beforehand. Now, I know people who are familiar with the film From Beyond are probably thinking, what in the world are you talking about? I mean, interdimensional aliens coming into our realm and trying to devour us? Well, maybe that's not exactly what it had to do with. We'll touch on exactly what I mean when we come back here on the Graylian Report.
Hi, Bob Tarmac, ReceptionRadioNetwork.com. I'm going to clue you into a show that I listen to every single week. It's Inception Radio with Jamie Havigan. It airs Friday nights, 6 p.m. Pacific, 9 p.m. Eastern. Jamie always brings on new guests every single week on a variety of topics. UFOs, it's paranormal, it's time travel, conspiracy theory, it's everything. And Jamie covers it in depth. When does it begin? It's Friday nights, 6 p.m. Pacific, 9 p.m. Eastern. I'll see you there.
Back to the program. You know, I think people hopefully are thinking about us all damn week, waiting for the next edition of the Graylian Report to come around. And if they're not, well, they for some reason find themselves tuning in every week regardless. It's like they just can't get it out of their head, and therefore here they are listening. Here you are, yes, listening yet again to the Graylian Report. And tonight we're discussing something that often gets stuck in my head, and that is the writing of H.P. Lovecraft. When we left out before the break, we were discussing the infamous story, one of my very favorites, which is From Beyond. It was made into a film back in the 1980s, and it's a really enjoyable film. I believe the actor's name is Jeffrey Combs that plays the protagonist in that film. The story dealt with a mad scientist by the name of Crawford Tillinghast, who creates a device that is capable of resonating, and in such a way that it causes the pineal gland to resonate and open up sort of a window to other realms where we can literally see strange creatures, beasts from other dimensions. And what's interesting to me about that is that there's this point that you get to in the dialogue where Tillinghast is describing for the narrator you know, how the pineal gland is, you know, not just the seat of the soul, of course, but literally a window to other realms. It is mankind's key to unlocking doors to other unseen realms. And in the story, this device causes this kind of resonant energy that causes the pineal gland to sort of vibrate, I guess, and then we're able to see into other dimensions. And we start seeing that right here in our midst, right around us, but in another dimension, we are surrounded by creatures. And not only when this device is in operation can we see these creatures, but they can see us, and they will literally be able to involve themselves with us and attack us and kill and eat us. Now, I thought that was just really interesting because first there's the pineal gland, and then there's the idea of this device kind of unlocking the pineal gland and allowing us to see into other realms. When we think about the research of Dr. Rick Strassman that took place back in the 1990s, you know, DEA-approved studies with the very powerful hallucinogen dimethyltryptamine that allowed for people who, you know, and again, we're going to get back to the pineal gland here in a moment, but during these experiences, these people, you know, under the effects of DMT were able to have all kinds of different interactions with beings and things that they described. Now, of course, this is, again, entirely hallucinatory, and whether or not there's anything to the interactions these people claim to have had with what they sometimes perceived as being different forms of sentient intelligence or alien intelligences, despite what may have actually been going on in those circumstances, it's interesting to note that Strassman theorizes that indeed the DMT, which of course was introduced in those studies from outside sources, DMT is also produced in the human body, and Strassman's theory is that it may actually be produced in the pineal gland within the brain. So again, here's this notion of the pineal gland being able to produce a endogenous release. Again, this is a theory of Strassman's that under certain circumstances, that there might be circumstances that would allow for an endogenous or an internal release of this DMT into the bloodstream, and hence it would cause a strange hallucination. One of the participants in the study had been a man who had studied, you know, very focused, intense meditation, and when administered dimethyltryptamine, it had no effect on him. But he said that he had managed to find other ways to reach ecstatic and even what might be described as hallucinatory, kaleidoscopic, visionary states only by focused meditation and breathing. And so what was theorized by Strassman was that if indeed he had actually gotten to a point where he utilized natural practices, meditative practices, to evoke these sorts of states naturally within his own mind, perhaps he actually unlocked metabolic pathways that released DMT into the body and caused the experience. And furthermore, that after having learned to do this without the introduction, you know, externally of DMT into the bloodstream, when he was actually given a dose, when he was actually using medical methods, when he was administered dimethyltryptamine in a laboratory like this, it had very little effect on him. So it's interesting to think that if indeed there is some way that this DMT, if it is indeed produced in the brain and it originates from the pineal gland, if it could be released into the body and cause what some perceive as being literally a state of mind, an altered state that is so real that it could be likened to actually having physical interaction with alien intelligences, keeping in mind, again, Terence McKenna often referred to that DMT state as being inhabited, it's remarkably similar to what was described in H.P. Lovecraft's story. But at that time, when that story was written, at the very latest, it was probably written, you know, sometime in the 20s or 30s.
36,
there you go.
That's the first time it was published.
Yeah, okay, well, there you go. So, you know, probably authored shortly before that. You know, the knowledge of... I know that there were some experiments with DMT and schizophrenic patients, I believe, that began to take place by the 1950s, but modern pharmacology at the time of the publication of this story, didn't understand the psychedelic effects of DMT. And as far as I understand, I don't think by the time that Strassman had begun to talk about the potential relationship between the pineal gland and DMT produced in the human body, I don't think anyone had, you know, speculated previously as to where the DMT comes from. We know that it's in our body. We don't know exactly what the origin or the point of origin actually may be for that. And again, that's still hypothetical on part of Rick Strassman. He'd begun to theorize about that. But we also know that there are other aspects of, you know, our bodies. You know, for instance, the way that the pineal gland seems to be related to the production of melatonin, which is a close chemical cousin to dimethyltryptamine. And, of course, melatonin governs not only various things with regard to our sleep and other processes of the body, but, you know, melatonin, according to some, you know, you can buy melatonin in the store and it's supposed to be used as a natural sleep aid. Some people have said that in large enough doses, melatonin can also even have the effect of causing very vivid dreams and nightmares and things like that. And early on, Strassman had even thought that maybe melatonin was the chemical that, that would be responsible for some of these, you know, unexpected endogenous chemical interactions in the body that could cause ecstatic states that some claim to achieve during meditation and things like that. So if you haven't read the book DMT, The Spirit Molecule, it's a fascinating read. I wish that there were more in the scientific community like Rick Strassman that would, you know, engage in speculation, but in such a way where he tried to do so with purpose of understanding the potential greater meaning behind experiences of those who were describing strange circumstances. You know, and unfortunately, it seems that so often today, especially in modern pharmacology, when someone describes having a strange experience or a strange interaction, maybe even with some form of intelligence or something like that, it gets diagnosed as being, you know, what would amount to a psychotic break from reality. Someone experiences sleep paralysis and they're being told that they're having a psychotic break from reality. You know, someone, you know, sees a ghost in their house and they are administered some sort of medication for, you know, some sort of a disease they may not actually even have. You know, I've got a friend that I was talking to a few weeks ago who told me, you know, I actually was diagnosed with schizophrenia last summer. And I said, what? I said, are you, what do you mean? Are you schizophrenic? Do you suffer from some sort of psychosis? And she said, well, no. She said, what it was I'd had different kinds of medications that I'd been prescribed. And I said, hold on, wait, were you on antidepressants? She said, yes. I said, had you been using pain medications? She says, well, not frequently. I said, do you ever take Tylenol? Well, yeah, I take Tylenol. I said, had you been on any sleeping medication to help you with sleeping? Yes. And I said, you know, did they tell you at the hospital that there was a potential for any kind of, you know, interaction between these different drugs that you were taking, these different medications? She said, yes, they did say that. But first they tried to say that because I was experiencing psychotic symptoms that I might be a candidate for schizophrenia. And the reason for that had been primarily because, well, guess what? At my age, which she's in her early 20s, she said this is often where schizophrenia begins to erupt in young patients like myself. And therefore, they were content, some of her doctors apparently, to tell her, hey, listen, you may have schizophrenia, and we may have to, guess what, pump you full of more medications to try and treat this. In her circumstances, I think she was better off once she got off the existing medications, and now she's perfectly fine. So not schizophrenic, suffered from some sort of a less-than-convenient drug interaction. It's kind of a scary thing, but that seems to happen so often. Medical misdiagnosis. There's an entire chapter devoted to that in my book, Magic, Mysticism, and the Molecule. Maybe we'll come back and talk about that a little bit more during the third hour of tonight's program. For the time being, we're going to wrap things up this hour. When we come back, more weird news, anomalies, and exopolitics from beyond the fringe. It is the Grayling Report. I'm Micah Hanks. We'll be back right after this.
Hey guys, Jamie Havoc in here for UFO Mag. Do you want to receive the best writing there is in ufology, the best writers, editors, and flat out the best magazine that ufology can offer? If so, I highly recommend UFO Magazine. You can check it out at ufomag.com. And if you mention that you heard this on radio, you can get 6 issues for $19.95. Check it out, ufomag.com. Don't miss out. And keep up to date on the hottest topics in ufology. For UFO Mag, this is Jamie Havkin.
Want to have some fun? Maybe get a little bit of insight. Get a lay of the land. Want to know what's really going on? Do what I do. Listen to Future Theater. It airs every Saturday, 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern, on the InceptionRadioNetwork.com. We'll see you there.
Hi, Bob Tarmack from InceptionRadioNetwork.com. I'm going to clue you into a show that I listen to every single week. It's Inception Radio with Jamie Havigan. It airs Friday nights, 6 p.m. Pacific, 9 p.m. Eastern. Jamie always brings on new guests every single week on a variety of topics. UFOs, it's paranormal, it's time travel, conspiracy theory, it's everything. And Jamie covers it in depth. When is it again? It's Friday nights, 6 p.m. Pacific, 9 p.m. Eastern. I'll see you there.
Politics. It's beyond the fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Grinion Report with your host, Mike Evans.
From hundreds of miles beneath terra firma in the depths of the hollow earth, welcome back to the program. We're broadcasting from our murky little bunker down here in the darkest depths of the disquiet that is the Mohorovic discontinuity. This is the Grinion Bunker. I'm Micah Hanks. Welcome to the program. Can you imagine? I have at least on one occasion gotten a correspondence from a listener who was displeased with the fact that we describe the bunker on the program and the fact that we broadcast from a bunker. This person was like, really? A bunker underground? I guess you're just trying to be cute. I think they're just jealous is what it is. I'd be jealous too if I didn't have the bunker, which is why we're so glad to be here. And we're so glad to welcome all of you every Tuesday night here into the bunker with us. I want to welcome you also to the website, if you haven't been over there just yet, www.grailienreport.com. That's G-R-A-L-I-E-N report.com. Well, I should probably just stop right, man. I'm just going to piss somebody off. Somebody's going to get mad because we're talking about the damn website now.
I was just going to say the bunker is way better than sleeping in my car.
Hey Micah, I'm going to need you to stop spamming my subreddit right now.
I just need you to stop, you know, that would be great.
Just stop spamming the subreddit.
Don't talk about, like, your website or anything like that, because, I mean, that's just where all the information, I mean, that's just where, like, the link to the podcast goes.
You're banned. Stealth banned.
People have this strange notion in their minds that that if you mention a website, or if you mention anything that sounds commercial, that, you know, there, you have therefore sold your soul, you're one of the holy half-dead, and that you're trying to draw everyone else in your immediate circle to the dark side. So all the listeners out there, you know, go ahead and run in terror, turn off your radios and turn off your computers and turn off your stereo systems if you're listening to this, you know, at home. You don't want to listen any further because, for goodness sake, we're going to corrupt you when we send you to the website, the Grailian Report. And for God's sake, whatever you do, don't go down in caves and don't go looking for hadals and all the kind of stuff that we talk about on this program. Yes, indeed. Because there are certain listeners out there, I'm sure, you know, by virtue of having expressed their personal distaste for our descriptions of the bunker and you know, the studio underground from which we broadcast. Yeah, we're not the only guys that broadcast from a bunker. In fact, there's actually a talk radio host, I believe, based out of Greenville, South Carolina, who also describes his studio as an underground bunker. Now, it may not be hundreds of miles beneath the ground, but this man describes his studio nonetheless as being a bunker. We're proud to be probably the deepest, darkest bunker anywhere below the earth. Broadcasting from the hollow earth, which is a concept that is tangent and rife throughout, tangent with a lot of the concepts discussed on this program first, and then rife with it throughout the claims of paranormality that we're trying to delve into on this program. But then again, those same individuals would probably also be very upset by our discussion of anything that could be deemed speculative, since, you know, Einstein never ever speculated, you know, Oppenheimer never speculated. Right. You know, Copernicus never speculated about anything that was going on out there. I'm sure that Stephen Hawking surely has never once in his life speculated about what could exist out there in the greater, you know, depths of what we call outer space. You know, and certainly we are fools for speculating within the 3 hours that we have every week with people here on this program, even broaching the subject of alien life, even touching on it, and it's speculating about what could exist beyond the confines of human perception, makes us idiots. Pseudoscience at its very best. Pure entertainment and of no intellectual merit whatsoever. So folks, turn your radios off right now. It's for your own good.
It wouldn't matter if their radios are off because we're on the interwebs.
That's right. Internet radio, which is so fantastic. We like that. Oh, well, anyway, but for those of you who haven't already turned off your laptops or closed the feed, the stream, you know, who haven't cut off your favorite podcast service or, you know, turned off your iPhone or iPad, however you prefer to listen, I would like to direct you over to GraylianReport.com. Because we've got a few things worthy of looking at here. First of all, I do want to point out that the Paradigm Symposium, which we're going to be having this October in Minneapolis, is online, not only at the, you know, its official website, ParadigmSymposium.com, but also we're on Facebook. You've got a page on Facebook that you can link to now, and that front and center at GraylianReport.com. If you go, you'll see the big logo that says Paradigm Symposium, and it has the Facebook thing linked up there. All you got to do is just go check that out, and you can follow the link to our official Facebook page. And there at the official Facebook page, of course, you can like us, and you can get continual updates about the Paradigm Symposium and what we'll be discussing and who the speakers are going to be. It's fantastic. So that's something worth checking out while you're there at the website. We also have links, of course, to the podcast and other supplemental information about the program. And we always, following each broadcast, link to different things that we discuss here on the program that you can download and you can find out more about just as well. All the stories we've touched on tonight and much more. And, of course, there's obviously a link to the podcast that is included there just as well. So that's all at GraylianReport.com. Check us out there on Facebook. And while you're at Facebook, you might also go ahead and have a look at the Graylian Report's official page. Right now we've got a lot of people who are following the program there. And throughout the week, from program to program, you can also get more news and updates from the Graylian gang that we post there on the page. Chris Hayes is always on there posting things, and I jump on there quite a good bit too, sharing news and links and things like that. And we also link the podcast there as well.
Oh, and real quick, speaking of posting things and things you cannot post, apparently in Ustream chat, you're not allowed to post URLs, which is incredibly infuriating. But back on the Lovecraft subject, I found a website that has literally everything Lovecraft has ever written. Apparently, for you fancy schmancy ebookers, you can get it on Nook quite easily. But the URL to read it in, you know, in text form on the web page is www.dragonbites. That's BYTES.com. And we'll go ahead and put that on the Graylian page as well as the Graylian Facebook page if you're interested.
Yeah, fantastic. We'll include that in the show notes so that way you can dig into that, because I can't believe, you know, how many people are unfamiliar with the work of H.P. Lovecraft, you know. And you know, Chris, I know you haven't read a lot of it, but I mean, you're at least familiar with who he was and what he wrote about, and so that's something that we'll certainly want to you know, touch on a bit more you know, on this program, because I always enjoy talking about H.P. Lovecraft. In fact, we had contacted a Lovecraft expert before tonight's broadcast that we had hoped to be able to talk more with and have on the program. And maybe we'll save that for a future episode because, you know, again, there are so many different Fortean angles that you can take with the discussion of H.P. Lovecraft. You know, that's just a fascinating substrata, you know, within paranormalia. And I think it's a fascinating area to kind of, you know, look at different connections and to tie in, you know, fiction and the strange and the unusual, which a lot of people would call fiction nonetheless, you know. We're talking about this sort of strange stuff. And speaking again, you know, this seems to be a running thing throughout tonight's program, where fiction and fantasy meet the strange and the unusual. And there's this story I found earlier. The headline reads, Merlin's Wizard Legacy Expands to New Claims That He Was Not of This Earth. I love this one.
Well, no, he was the devil's son, so he was from hell.
Merlin, the devil's son. You know, now, for folks, of course, when we're talking about Merlin, we are talking about the famous Wizard of Arthurian legends. And there is a new interpretation of the Merlin legend, which is apparently espoused in this book titled Merlin, Knowledge and Power Through the Ages by British researcher and Professor Stephen Knight. And this book offers a new translation of the prophecies of Merlin, which, among other insights about pre-medieval England, also makes the unique claim, to say the least, that the wizard used... listen to this. That the wizard used UFO sightings and arranged for quote-unquote alien visits to shore up the Arthurian legend. Now, what's most interesting to ufologists today in 2012 is the possibility, based on Merlin prophecies, that this wizard was not of this earth. Now, you knew that Nostradamus was famous for making, prophetic statements about the future of mankind. You know, his visions and his infamous prophecies. Did you know that there were Merlin prophecies as well? That's fascinating, and it's frankly news to me. And that, again, that maybe this wizard was actually not of this earth, according to researcher Thomas Lichtman, who features the prophecies of Merlin at the annual Oregon County Fair in Eugene this year. Now, in turn, Lichtman also states that at the fair this July, we will reveal the true identity of Merlin based on new research from our friends in Glastonbury. Lichtman went on to explain a recent research visit to the area, which is, of course, a small town in Somerset, England, that attracted him as a former University of Oregon graduate student who studied neo-pagan beliefs, because he says this is one of the only places on Earth that we actually know that Merlin walked. In turn, Lichtman told Hulick.com that during a February 2nd interview, he had spent 7 months poring through documents in the town of Bristol that describes in detail how locals in Glastonbury during King Arthur's time viewed Merlin as, quote-unquote, not of this earth, which is apparently a concept that's fairly common among discussion of wizards. I don't remember exactly in Tolkien's fiction what the word is that they used for the wizards, like Gandalf and the others. There was one, there was the hippie wizard that was lesser known, Radagast the Brown, and then there was Gandalf the Grey, who became a white later on, and then of course there was Saruman. But these wizards were kind of viewed as being, in the Tolkien mythos, kind of not exactly human, maybe something else that took a human form, I think.
So would Gandalf going from the gray to the white kind of be like going Super Saiyan?
Sort of.
Because he fell off that thing when he was stopping the thing. I don't know. I don't really care a lot about Tolkien, but...
you know exactly what happened. Don't
But he didn't die. Everyone thought he died. But so he didn't die. He just kind of, as he fell, transcended into like some super wizard. I really don't like Tolkien. I'm sorry.
Really? You don't like Tolkien? Yeah. I thought everybody liked the little... How could you not like Hobbits?
I liked The Hobbit. I didn't care two bits about the whole Lord of the Rings trilogy.
The Lord of the Rings trilogy, it's well written and it's fantastic stuff. I like those, but I'll tell you, my favorite book of the Tolkien books was from the Middle Earth series was The Hobbit. I always loved The Hobbit. Great book. It's one of the best works of fiction in my opinion. If you're interested in that kind of Dungeons and Dragons type stuff, which of course those games and things like that, and all the role playing fantasy games of today are most of them kind of are, nod back to the Tolkien interpretation of folklore and history. And that's kind of what, Tolkien was trying to do. He had said that he, with Middle Earth, wanted to create a history for Britain that didn't actually exist. And I, again, was unaware of the fact that, there was a historical Merlin believed to have been stomping around ancient Glastonbury.
Well, and also, back on the Tolkien thing, and it's my last rip. If you're suffering from insomnia, just go ahead and read the Silmarillion. You'll be out.
Like,
before the first chapter's done, the Silmarillion will be, you'll fall asleep.
Yes, it's a rather long and involved history of Middle-earth and its happenings, indeed. But, Tolkien also, he was also a translator, and... he kind of retold some of these, these legends. I think there was the story, Farmer Giles of Ham, and then, of course, there was the, Sir Gawain and the Green Knight. Some of these, classic legends, which I think, Sir Gawain and the Green Knight got into some of the Arthurian legends as well. Tolkien popularized retellings of those as well.
And Sir Gawain or Gawain, I think there's like five different pronunciations.
Yeah. You got to keep in mind, I'm a Southern boy.
That was part of the Arthurian legend. That was all...
Exactly. Yeah,
part of that.
Yeah, and see, keeping in mind that, you know, I am a Southern gentleman, and therefore my pronunciation of certain words may vary at times. Gawain, Gawain, I've heard both. And in fact, you know, actually, with regard to a lot of the Tolkien names, I've heard different pronunciations. I always, you know, I recognized Frodo's companion Sam's last name as being Gamgee. But in the film interpretations of those, it was Gamgee. So again, you know, I think that there's, you know, some variance that, you know, erupts from time to time. And I'm not someone who has ever paid such terrible attention to details that I, you know, get into squabbles with people over whether it's Gamgee or Gamgee. Okay. I'm sure somebody's going to write us or call us and really criticize us forever, you know, speculating, you know, one against the other.
It's actually Gamga.
Gamga, yes, exactly. Yes, they all had it wrong, especially the film. So sorry, Peter Jackson and all you guys.
One thing is for certain, hobbits love taters.
Hobbits love taters. They'd probably get along real well with, you know, Hadals, right? Of course, you know.
Well, no, they wouldn't get along at all.
They wouldn't?
Because the hobbits would continually try to eat.
Oh, yeah, they'd eat the Hadal babies. And then they would eventually wipe out the entire species.
You know, boil them, mash them, stick them in a stew.
Would you stop being cute? You're just being cute again, and people don't like that. They don't want you to just be cute and make up silly stuff.
Oh, I'm sorry. Only seriousness.
But see, I wasn't really under the impression that, you know, I know that there is believed to be, you know, some factual basis, you know, for the Arthurian legends. There are a lot of different approaches to looking at that, but that a lot of it was kind of built upon, and there's a mythology that, you know, that Mr. White, with his Once and Future King and some of these, you know, literary interpretations of the legends, you know, kind of built upon, which are obviously mythological in nature. But this, this Mr. Lichtman here is interpreting this, apparently. Thomas Lichtman treats the concept of Merlin as being, you know, a real character, and in addition to that, being one who at the time of his existence in real life was believed not to be really of this world by those who knew him. So this begs the apparent question. It's a question on some people's minds, and one that I didn't realize was even on the table to begin with. Was Merlin an alien? You know, some people have even said that Jesus Christ may have been an alien, or perhaps Buddha. Some of the greatest, you know, minds and philosophers and spiritual leaders of our you know, existence throughout time have been aliens. Was Merlin? Who knows? We'll discuss that more when we come back.
For most of us, chocolate is a guilty pleasure. Come on, admit it. You've got a sweet tooth just like the rest of us. But if I told you that eating chocolate was actually really good for your health and happiness, you'd probably say I was in La La Land. Hey, I wouldn't argue. Here's why. Every batch of the fine handcrafted chocolates at La La Land Organics Raw Chocolate is made from scratch, using organic, fair trade, and 100% natural ingredients. From the first bite, you'll know you're enjoying true quality, and the heart shape isn't the only way you'll feel the love. In fact, every chocolate from La La Land Organics is made by Melody Dawn Germain herself, and according to her own special recipe. You'll be enjoying Ecuadorian heirloom cacao in every bite, along with a selection of wholesome herbs and superfood supplements that not only make La La Land Organics delicious, but really good for your health and happiness. They're all natural, gluten-free, and no dairy, soy, or refined sugars are included, which help them boost your energy, reduce stress, and promote longevity. And as if healthy organic chocolates didn't remove the guilt factor enough, Melody ships all her orders in reusable, food-grade, non-BPA containers designed to eliminate toxic residue and cut down on environmental waste. Be sure and visit Melody's website at www.mdgnewmedia.com. That website again is mdgnewmedia.com. Just click chocolate in the toolbar at the top of the page. You can't miss it. And while you're there, you can see a full list of the ingredients that will be sure to put a smile on your face. And I promise, it's guilt-free. La La Land Organics Raw Chocolate. Why wait? That website again is mdgnewmedia.com.
Diary entry, August 15th. My joints ache. Today I can hardly move. I need some answers.
September 3rd. I'm tired all the time.
What's going on? June 8th, I woke up with a rash on my face. I want to know why.
For answers, ask your doctor the right question. Could I have lupus? For answers, for support, for hope, visit couldihavelupus.gov or call 1-800-994-9662. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Office on Women's Health and the Ad Council.
mountains of Appalachia. It's the Graylian Report with Micah Hanks. To join the program by phone, call 828-398-4886. Skype users can reach the program by calling Skype ID Graylian Report. And now, from hundreds of miles beneath terra firma, in the depths of the hollow earth, live from the Graylian Bunker, it's Micah Hanks.
Yes, according to conventional wisdom, Merlin is indeed a legendary figure. He was best known as the Wizard, of course, of Arthurian legend, and that's what we've been discussing here on the Graylian Report, because new claims made by a gentleman by the name of Thomas Lichtman are that Merlin, the historical character, might have actually been not of this world. Now, the standard depiction of this character first appears in Geoffrey Monmouth's Historia Regum Britanniae, okay, an 1136 era document, which was based kind of on a blending of different historical and legendary figures. Geoffrey combined existing stories of Myrddin Wyllt, a North Bythronic prophet and madman with no connection to King Arthur, according to, I'm looking at Wikipedia right now, with tales of Romano-British war leader Ambrosius Aurelianus. I know anus is in the word. Let me just put it there. Try and sound it out, guys. No, I can't do it tonight. Anyway, but the idea here is that, you know, these previously mythical and historical figures were kind of rolled together to create this composite known as Merlin Ambrosius, okay? Sometimes also Merlin or Myrddin Wyllt. And so you draw from these different cultural interpretations of these characters, and this kind of this amalgamation comes together that emerged in the Arthurian legends known as Merlin. But again, it was primarily a kind of a blending of different mythological elements that brought forth this singular Merlin character. And again, the idea of Merlin the wizard being an actual alien, I mean, that's a new one to me. But studying these neo-pagan beliefs, according to this Mr. Lichtman, you know, he traveled overseas to study neo-pagan beliefs in parts of England. And he says that he stayed in the old home near where Merlin had lived along the River Brew. He even explained that Glastonbury today is much like the part of Eugene, Oregon, where he is originally from, and the county fair that takes place there this July, where he will put forth some of these ideas. Being a sort of New Age community where people look like hippies or something out of a Renaissance fair today in 2012. At the same time, Lichtman describes going on several private tours that took him deep into the world of Merlin, to where we viewed artifacts that are tied to the Holy Grail and of King Arthur, who Merlin served while here on Earth. You know, I hate to say this, but it sounds a lot to me like he may, you know, want so badly this individual to have walked in the footsteps of Merlin and Arthur and these incredible characters. You know, and I think it's easy to do this. You know, that you want so badly for something to be real that you go and you incorporate, you know, the mythological elements into your own kind of vision of history, which in a sense, it's kind of what Tolkien did too. He said he wanted there to be a rich history or mythology for England, you know, like the Greeks had with their gods, and, you know, and like other parts of the world, you know, the Indian, you know, Vedas and the Sanskrit epics, you know, told these incredible wars and things. And he said that, you know, he wanted that for England, and therefore the Middle Earth stories, you know, with the stories of the Hobbit and the Lord of the Rings and all this, they stemmed out of that interpretation of existing mythology and folklore, and his hope to try and kind of rewrite and present a new kind of mythology for England and the British Isles. So, but then again, I think still there's a pretty distinct difference between what we call mythology and folklore and then actual history. And maybe there was a king, you know, that was the archetypal, you know, essence of what became later what we know in myth as King Arthur. But I don't think that King Arthur, in the literal sense, had an alien wandering around, you know, reading poems to him and things like that and casting spells. Yes, this was Merlin. It was Spock, actually, is what it was. It was Spock temporally displaced on Earth, and he became the science advisor to King Arthur.
God, that'd be the worst ever. Just this hyper-logical D-bag.
I don't call
Spock a D-bag lightly, because I love Spock and I love Logic, yeah. but imagine the time, you know, if this was real, you know, what, maybe the mid 400s England.
Are we putting the Historia Regum Britannia was written in 1136, which is one of the earlier references to Merlin. So I mean, I guess yes, obviously the you know, from,
okay, we'll say early second millennium.
The legends would stem from a time prior to that. Yeah.
But
prior to the
1100s. Goodness. Just you've got these knights and people eating meat with knives and ripping things apart with hands and not valuing really intelligence at all. And then you've got hyperlogical Spock, just like
in the midst of all this. Yeah, it's fascinating.
I'm sure as a kid, Arthur would get so many Vulcan nerve pinches. It's ridiculous.
But I would imagine, again, I would imagine Merlin, the mythic character of Merlin, as being, you know, likened to like a, you know, like Spock. And I got news for you, as captain of this ship, buddy, you're Merlin. Oh, I'm sorry, I meant Spock. Maybe there's really little distinction between the two anymore.
I'm all right with that now, but Spock, I would be murdered in medieval England.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, but if you were Spock, but then again, you'd also be Merlin. I mean, Spock is Merlin. Merlin is Spock. That's what we need. New Graylian Report merchandise that has Spock is Merlin. It's code. There you go. We figured it out. So Merlin was actually Spock, who traveled back in time and, being separated from the Starship Enterprise, did what only he could do best, and he became science advisor to King Arthur. Spock was the science advisor, right?
Yeah.
You guys are... Come on!
You're the Trekkie over here.
I don't
think
he was science advisor. He was first mate. He was number one, or number two.
I thought in the first film, though, when Spock came back, that he came on board again, remember, as science advisor to Kirk.
The first film when Spock came back? Which
no, no,
film
in the
you talking?
No, in the first Star Trek film.
Okay.
So you remember Spock had been on his home planet and everything, and you remember he was going through that ritual.
Maybe when he came back, he was science advisor, but during the series, he may have been the science advisor. I don't really recall, because I spent a majority of my Star Trek time watching The Next Generation.
Yeah.
But he was science advisor.
Well, I was going to say, you know, could we maybe... No, we won't do this. I was going to say, we don't want to ask the... I don't want to even say his name too loud, but the creepy artificial intelligence Captain Kirk, you know, that's going to creep people out, you know, if we bring him on. I mean, I like having Kirk bot in here talking with us, but I actually typed into Google, was Spock the science advisor, and the first link that comes up says Spock is in the kitchen venting. And then the second one
is... There you go, guys.
The second link is Shut Up, Spock, How Battlestar Galactica Beat Trek Babble. And then the third is Spock Memory Alpha, the Star Trek Wiki. But still, I can't find it. It refers to Spock as having become the celebrated ambassador and advisor to the Vulcan Science Academy. But again, I thought that, you know, he went on. Yeah, Star Trek, the motion picture. Yeah, Spock arrives as replacement science officer.
That's science officer.
Okay, so he hadn't actually initially been that. Okay, but see, I knew that at some point Spock became science advisor to Captain James Kirk of the Starship Enterprise.
And, you know, let me just tell you, you mentioned Battlestar Galactica. Mm-hmm. Don't ever mention Don't ever mention Battlestar Galactica on here again if you guys ever want to talk about anything else.
I think what we have here is a failure to communicate, Chris.
Well, that's cool. You haven't seen.
We have
that's
a
cool
listener.
Hey, everyone, Micah has never seen Cool Hand Luke.
Yeah, it's pretty terrible, Micah. But, we have a listener saying that Spock was the science officer, definitely.
Well, there you go. See, I didn't think so. I'm not a huge Trekkie, and that's why I don't know this sort of stuff. I like Star Trek, but I'm not, like, enthralled by it. I'll have to get all... Is it on Netflix? You know, I'll have to watch all the old episodes. I know that there are some interesting things about Star Trek that I do know. Of course, for instance, one of the first interracial kisses that was depicted on, you know, television, on a television program, was between Captain Kirk and actually it was an alien. So really, we're talking about an interspecies kiss that was depicted. But, you know, it was an African-American actress that portrayed that alien on that episode. And there are a number of other interesting things, too, about Star Trek, you know, for all those movie... actually, it's not movie, I guess. It's... What would you call a person who loves television? That's not a cinephile, because that's a person who loves movies, you know, like Michael Bolton, somebody like that. But, well, anyway, I'd said again what we had here, guys, and I apologize if there was any failure to communicate, but one thing that is for certain, there's no failure in communication between plants. Did you know that plants actually can communicate? This is scientific fact, okay? And even though I'm not the science advisor on board this starship, I feel that I am accurate in bringing this information to the forefront. Yes, indeed, exactly how plants manage not only to communicate but warn one another of danger. BBC News recently reported about this recently, that folks, for the first time, scientists at Exeter University have captured on film the process by which plants have managed to alert to one another to possible dangers. Now, when a plant is under attack, let's say that, for instance, you've got a different kind of caterpillar or some other kind of an herbivore coming along and it's eating a plant. Well, when that plant perceives that it is under attack, it releases a kind of gas that is capable of being, for lack of a better term, interpreted by plants nearby. Okay. And these other plants are able to protect themselves from an oncoming attack when they interpret this, when they catch wind, so to speak, of this gas released by a plant that's already being attacked. Now, it's already known that plants are capable of secreting quick-acting toxins that help ward off herbivores that seek to consume them. But now scientists at Exeter University have made the new discovery. They've likened their observations to listening in on a conversation. Upon release of the warning gas by one plant that's already under attack, other plants nearby will begin to react in a way that shows that they are actually preparing for a similar attack, releasing these sorts of toxins to try and ward off animals that might try and consume them after coming into contact with those gases released by the initial plant. Following this remarkable study, and it is truly remarkable, scientists are now wondering if there could actually literally be what they liken to a chatter going on between plants all around us. Now, what was the film? Was it The Happening? Is that the film? Was it one of M. Night Shyamalan Ding Dong's movies?
Something's Happening.
Was that the film? Bagusto.
Yes, that's the film. God.
Weren't you in the trailer for that, Micah?
I was in a spoof trailer.
Something's Happening.
Yeah, it's still online. I'm sure if you search for Micah Hanks, The Happening trailer, yes.
I'll pull up the link and we'll put it on the show notes.
Okay, yes. But no, there was an action. The film, that was the film, right? Where plants start to communicate with one another via a gas, and then people start dying because, the plants are basically killing people off. I think that was the gist of it. But this is incredible because, again, this idea of fiction, portrayals of science fiction and horror actually having some bearing in real life. This has been, a common element we've discussed throughout the entire program tonight. And here yet again, new studies literally show that plants not only can release gases and are capable of protecting themselves through chemical changes that they produce when they feel that they are under attack, but these plants can communicate with one another. And it's been likened to a chatter between plants that's going on all the time around us. And often in the past, studies like those of Cleve Baxter have referred to, for instance, his ability to monitor what seem to be changes that occur in a plant, I guess, for lack of a better term, probably, that occur in the plant's I don't know if you'd say physiology, but I don't want to say the behavior of the plant, but I mean, well, here's what happened. Cleve Baxter's experiments involved Baxter holding, or rather hooking a plant up to a polygraph machine because he wanted to see if there was any kind of electrical stimuli that would be registered on the polygraph readout when water, which was poured into a pot, reached the leaves of the plant. He wanted to see if there was any kind of electrical differential that, could be registered. And during this experiment, at one point, Baxter, I think, was cutting one of the leaves off of the plant or something like that, and noticed that the polygraph machine showed a response as though the plant had reacted to being damaged, being cut, or being attacked, so to speak. And during many of his experiments, Cleve Baxter noticed that he could not only physically cut a leaf and see that this response would be garnered with a polygraph machine that the plant was, hooked to, but also that in many instances when he would merely think about approaching a plant and cutting the leaves, that a similar response would be would be achieved, as though the plant had somehow anticipated the attack, okay, before it actually happened. Now, if he thought about attacking a plant, but he didn't really have any intention of doing so, the plant would just sit there and ignore him. But as soon as he really meant to come forward and maybe hold a lighter up under a leaf and attack that leaf, if he hadn't actually done it yet, but was moving toward the leaf with the intention of doing it, the registered response on the polygraph equipment would show that the plant was freaking out. He referred to it as though the plant were screaming. Now, this has been viewed as absolutely pseudoscientific, and he's been made fun of, Cleve Baxter, for years and years and years. But yet, in a similar study, we can see that plants, and this was unknown until recently, that plants can literally release a gas that not only communicates to other plants, this is something else that Baxter noticed, that when one plant was being attacked, get this, he said that if a polygraph machine were attached to other plants in the room, they would react with the scream, okay, when another plant in the room was being attacked. Now we have these studies that show that these plants do indeed actually release a physical substance into the air, a gas, that when other plants nearby come into contact with that gas, they react in a specified way. They protect themselves, anticipating an attack. We also know that plants are capable of protecting themselves when they're being attacked by releasing certain chemical agents into their leaves and the like that are toxic and would ward off herbivores and insects and things that would seek to consume their leaves. So we know that now, without the shadow of a doubt, that plants are capable of not only attempting to defend themselves, but communicating in preemptive ways to help others defend themselves from an attacker. And yet, these initial studies by Cleve Baxter, which seem to show very similar things, have always been looked at as pseudoscientific and silliness. Maybe, just maybe, there is some justification for those kinds of experiments now. And I would be fascinated, indeed, but not surprised, if indeed it were found that these plants, members of the flora kingdom, are indeed more capable of what we call communication, and if not a sentience or an awareness, they're at very least more, because there are fundamental differences between plants and humans. There isn't really a central nervous system in a plant like a human has. And so a lot of people say when you cut down a tree, they're not going to feel pain. It's not going to be a circumstance where a plant's going to be able to feel and recognize what is happening to it like a person would. And some people would say, even with regard to these studies, even though these plants can warn others nearby to defend themselves, this is just an evolutionary byproduct of protecting their proliferation as a species. And therefore it's conducive to their survival. But at what level do you really draw distinctions between an organism, okay, something that is alive, a living organism that is capable of not only protecting itself, but warning others when they may be in danger? That is communication, but is it not a sentient form of communication? Is it just kind of like an automated response that these plants put out? I mean, it really, when you get down to it on a deeper level, we get to a point where we have to question, what is a consciousness? What is, awareness? And we also are forced, on some level to consider whether or not certain plants, or maybe all plants, have some form of sentient awareness. It may not be like human awareness. But, I see someone in the chat room saying, what would happen if vegetable consciousness was confirmed? Boy, it would really ruin the day for a lot of vegans, wouldn't it?
Then we wouldn't be allowed to eat anything.
Yeah, we would have to find a way to genetically engineer all of our food.
Soylent Green is people.
Soylent Green is people, indeed. What do you eat when you find out that the plants that you think that you're, protecting all the animals out there from untimely deaths from? What do you do when you find out that plants could potentially be just as capable of awareness as, other animals?
The same thing I do when I eat other animals. Eat them anyway.
And that's the thing, is it seems cruel, but unfortunately, these are questions that have to be asked. And I don't think that it's fair to point the finger at someone like Cleve Baxter, who, as a result of being he was a polygraph expert. He didn't claim to be anything other than that, but he was, again, by virtue of being interested in polygraph examinations and the use of polygraph, which, again, I think that clearly what polygraph tests can show are changes and fluctuations in the attitudes and certain physical conditions, you know, with a person, but they aren't conclusive in terms of being able to determine a person's actual intention, telling the truth or falsifying claims, and therefore polygraph tests are not, you know, allowed in court for that very reason. They aren't very consistent. But that said, they obviously show, very, very clearly that there are certain changes, in physical attributes about a human being and the way that they behave and the way that they might feel and the way that they may react under certain circumstances and under certain kinds of pressure. And again, similar things were being observed with plants when hooked up to these machines by Cleve Baxter. And furthermore, and that's what's incredible to me, he said it was something almost like what you might liken to being some sort of a psychic phenomenon, where one plant being hurt would cause a reaction with other plants in the room. But now we know that a gas is actually released by plants that warns others nearby that one is being damaged. So that begs the question, was Baxter onto something early on? And should his examinations of the way that these plants reacted with polygraph testing equipment be reexamined now that we know what we know about how these plants literally communicate with one another?
Yeah, I was just gonna say this whole topic was making me think about that story. I can't remember the guy's name, but what was it? I think it was DMT. And
it was Dennis McKenna. It was Terrence McKenna's brother.
That's right.
He was it was during an ayahuasca vision experience. Dennis McKenna, during, the key ingredient in ayahuasca is what?
DMT.
That's right, dimethyltryptamine. And so, well, in certain variations of ayahuasca, the hallucinogenic varieties, have not only DMT but monoamine oxidase inhibitors, which allow the DMT to become orally active. And so, this is a tea used in the Amazon used in rituals, and people consume the tea, and therefore they have very long, drawn out visionary experiences. And during this experience with Dennis McKenna, he said that he, in his vision, became a water droplet, was brought through a plant and made to experience photosynthesis. It was actually a liana, Banisteriopsis caapi. And at the end of the experience, as he's coming out of the vision, having gone through the plant and experienced this photosynthesis, he says a voice, the spirit of the liana plant, speaks to him and says, "You monkeys only think you're in charge of things." And that, to me, is such an enigmatic story, you know?
Well, and RBJ brings up a good point. I completely forgot in my readings of all of Carlos Castaneda's books that I had to read in college, and I really quite enjoyed. But in Castaneda's books, says RBJ, Don Juan explains to Carlos that trees hate humans.
And why would they not hate humans? Because look, I mean, think about deforestation. You know, think about how we cut down trees, and we never think about, you know, hurting plants and things like that. You know, I remember, what was it? I had a friend once who was diagnosed by his doctors with having a unique kind of sensitivity. And because he had begun to think that there was something wrong with him, he had begun to think that there was something going on, and that he had begun suffering from some kind of, maybe even some mild form of psychosis. Again, he goes to the doctor, and this is so common among people's experiences that they go to the doctor and they experience something strange, and they're diagnosed with some form of psychosis when really they've just maybe opened their mind to some strange new circumstance, and it caused, you know, a kind of psychological aberration. Now, it didn't get that far with this fellow. This friend of mine had merely begun to feel that he was perceiving things, you know, maybe even at times not hearing voices but perceiving presences around him. And he went and talked to his doctor about this and said, "I'm really concerned. Should I get checked for some kind of, you know, mental disorder or something like that?" And the doctor said, "No, it seems that you're just hypersensitive, and that, you know, you are just more sensitive than other people, and you may be perceiving things in your environment that, you know, the average person might not be, you know, entirely aware of." Okay, that said, I was sitting in my driveway with him. You know, I was in my early 20s, and we were hanging out. He was just a year older than me, and we were sitting there, and he says, "Did you hear that?" And it was dark outside, and we were actually in the driveway of my parents' house, and they live way up in the woods and everything. And he says, "Did you hear that?" And I said, "Hear what?" And he says, I thought I heard a voice, but there couldn't be anyone all the way out here. I don't know what I was hearing, though." He says, "For all I know, maybe what I was hearing were the trees, the voices of the trees themselves, because we were surrounded on all sides by trees." It sounds crazy, but who knows? And thinking about, you know, deforestation and, you know, using trees, you know, in the construction of homes and houses and things like that. Maybe trees, maybe plants do have every right to hate humans. Kind of a scary thought, huh?
Would your business survive a disaster? Nearly two-thirds of businesses aren't prepared for an emergency. And 40% of businesses that experience a disaster never recover. Make an emergency plan now, before it's too late. For a free online tool that helps you develop an emergency plan to keep your business up and running should disaster strike, visit ready.gov/business. Brought to you by the Federal Emergency Management Agency, the American Red Cross, and the Ad Council.
All right, guys, I know you've been putting it off. Your thirst for knowledge is incredible, insatiable, but your wallet says otherwise. So you haven't been able to subscribe to all those classy magazines out there bringing you to the edges of the fringe just like you and I do every week here on the Graylian Report. Well, good news for you. You can now subscribe to Intrepid Magazine for an entire year and just pay $19.95. Really? That's it? It's no joke. $19.95 will get you an entire year of incredible insight from authors like Nick Redfern, Scotty Roberts, and of course yours truly. It's Intrepid Magazine, boldly going. Visit www.intrepidmag.com today and feel your mind expanding tomorrow.
Back to the third and final hour of the Graylian Report. It's actually the final segment of the final hour of this week's edition of the program. Hey, before we wrap things up, I want to send you over again. Check out www.paradigmsymposium.com. If you haven't signed up yet today, I want to say I'm very glad. Friday we launched the website. We started ticket sales. This is going to be a tremendous event. And it's looking like already that the primary seller, as a matter of fact, I think if we were to put the numbers together, there are 400% more of the biggest tickets selling. There are three brackets of tickets, which are, of course, the big ticket that gets you full access to the conference. And then you've got the bigger ticket, which gets you not only the conference, but also the banquet that we're going to be having, which features a live panel discussion Saturday evening with many of our guests, including Eric Von Daniken and George Norrie. In fact, Scotty Roberts and I are going to be on that panel as well. It's going to be one hell of a conversation. You don't want to miss that. But then also, there's a third and final bracket for tickets, which includes a VIP cocktail that'll take place before dinner that night of the conference.
And it's not just one cocktail. It's a whole cocktail hour.
Yes, there's an entire cocktail hour. It might even be more than an hour. I don't know. You know, but we're going to have George Norrie speaking earlier that afternoon and a bunch of the other speakers. You know, my new book, which will be coming out later this year, my new book, I'm almost hesitant to say too much about that right now. We'll save that for a later date. But I know my new book will be celebrating the release party of that book, as well as a new book that will be coming out by my cohort in this endeavor, Mr. Scotty Roberts of Intrepid Magazine. But Scotty and I are going to be emceeing the event. We're also going to be speakers. We're going to be there all weekend. It's going to be fantastic. And if you want to come and chill with the Graylian gang, we are going to be doing a live broadcast of this program from Paradigm Symposium as well. But you want to be there for that. You don't want to have to just listen in. You want to be there. We're going to do a broadcast in front of a live studio audience, and Scotty's going to be sitting in on the program. We're going to have, hopefully, Mr. Von Daniken and Giorgio Tsoukalos and Philip Coppens, Maridi Jones, and all these folks, you know, joining us on the program for segments of this live special broadcast before a studio audience of the Graylian Report from live from the Paradigm Symposium. So that's going to be this October in Minneapolis, Minnesota. You don't want to miss it. Just check out www.paradigmsymposium.com to learn more about that. And I'll just tell you, right now, the biggest ticket, which is the VIP cocktail, the banquet, and all access pass to all the speakers, that's the ticket that has been selling the most, to the point that I'm already concerned. We haven't even been on sale for a week yet, and I'm already concerned that we're going to sell out of those. And space is limited, so you want to go ahead and jump on that when you can. It's not going to be something that you're going to want to miss. This is going to be the event to end all events. And for all we know, it may be the perfect way to see the world out in style, since, of course, the Mayans, if they're right, we might not have another, you know, chance at this after 2012, huh? So that said, you know, it's a shame that that when it comes to the end of the world, and who knows what that could possibly entail, wasn't it an African folk singer, Chris, apparently came back from the dead just in time to see the world end.
Yeah, that's correct. This one comes from the timeslive.co.za. It's a South African online news source. Fans flock to the home of resurrected music star. And unfortunately, since the webcam is non-operational, anytime you hear me say resurrected, I'm going to be using air finger quotes.
Okay,
all
sure.
Right.
Well, maybe I can. I've got a webcam right here, but the thing is that, well, okay, I won't get into all that right now.
Anyway, the resurrection of this multi-award-winning Maskandi musician, I'm going to stumble through this name as best I can, because apparently, much like Norwegian and, you know, many countries to the Great White North, it looks like this particular culture is not super fond of vowels.
Well, I'm sure you'll do about as well or better probably than I would do. Go ahead, Chris, in good faith, proceed.
Okay, the musician's name is Kulekane. Goodness, yeah, Kulekane. Kulekane, his first name. Kwake. His nickname in parentheticals is, it's got MGQ right next to each other. So I know that I'm assuming it's kind of a Bantu language. So it's Ngukwa, many, I don't know. And his last name is Mseleku, which I will be referring to him as through the entirety of this reading.
Mseleku.
So much easier to say. Anyway. This guy, Maskandi musician Mseleku, caused widespread confusion, with even close family members arguing about whether he had returned from the dead or not. Mseleku, who had been thought to be dead since December of 2009, returned home in, good lord, Nkuthu last Saturday. The singer
sounds like something from an H.P. Lovecraft story.
I know.
Nkuthu.
He came back to the sunken city of Roulet. But I shouldn't make light. This guy came back from the dead. Just like me, we're brethren, but not really. The singer's return has been met with some pretty mixed emotions. Mseleku said that he had been trapped in a zombie hell for a little over 2 years until he could find the strength to free himself. He says that he knows his story is hard to believe, but vows to prove to his family, friends, and fans that he is the real Mseleku. He also promised to return to making music as soon as he feels that he's strong enough. A relative who introduced himself as Bongani Nkube, excuse me, claims to have grown up with the singer and said that he knows Mseleku like the palm of his hand. Nkube vows that he and the other detractors will not be taking this so-called resurrection lying down. He says that he's prepared to take this issue to the highest court in the land if need be. Mseleku's grandfather believes his grandson and said that he doubted the authenticity of the claim at first, but has over time become sure that this is indeed his resurrected grandson. Okay, that was the information I looked at yesterday. Mm-hmm. There was, in fact, an update. Police have opened an investigation and taken DNA samples in an effort to prove the identity of the resurrected singer, and the results are expected any day now. Well, now, thanks to the folks at io9.com, we have information stating that the resurrected singer was, in fact, a fake. What led to this conclusion was not the DNA test, because that hasn't come back yet. What led to this conclusion was the fact that Mseleku had a gold tooth that he did not have prior to his death.
So basically, dude dies with nice teeth, comes back with gold teeth.
Well, what if maybe, you know, while he was a zombie, he was just wandering around, he bumps into something, and then the voodoo priestess that has enslaved him, you know, has a couple of golden teeth installed. So
and, you know, maybe they do a little, you know, oral surgery.
Yeah.
Well, I want you guys to take it from
me. Because I'm sure he had no recollection of that oral surgery ever taking place.
Well, of course not. But I just want you guys to take it from me, a real zombie, that that we don't offer dental.
Oh, there's not dental coverage for zombies?
No.
Hmm. So what you're saying is that this man may not have been a zombie.
Yeah. More than likely an imposter.
You don't say.
All right, Nick Cage. In fact, I'd go so far as to say he is an imposter.
You don't say.
If you guys could see this, Mike is making the most horrific face. He's got these tentacles coming out from under his nose. And,
yeah, like a tuloid start making their way out. So you mean the guy wasn't a zombie at all, huh?
No.
Darn, I guess I have to get my hopes up. And with that, my friends, we're going to have to leave you. Another fantastic week beyond the fringe. On behalf of Dick Oakley, John Anderson, Holly, producer Chris Hayes, engineer Matt Oakley, and yours truly, the mouth of the South, Micah Hanks, we bid you adieu, my friends. Until next week, we are the Graylians, and stay strange.